My honor on the second battlefield study that we'll do here on All Marine Radio to welcome somebody who's been on the program before and just back from Vietnam. His name is Nick War, who I had a chance to meet at Camp Pendleton at the rededication of the battle colors here, I don't know, about a month or so ago. So, Nick, first of all, thanks for doing this. Always fun to have you on.
It's great to be with you, Mac, and I'm looking forward to our conversations.
All right, before we get into the conversation about Nick and I are our alumni of Charlie 15, and Nick fought with Charlie 15 in the city of Hue during the during offensive operations against the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong that had moved into the area and ultimately annihilating them from most of Vietnam. You don't hear that much when it's reported. It's called the Tet Offensive. There's a better term for it. It's certainly not offensive. It started out as an offensive, but when that thing flips over on top of you, that's not an offensive anymore, and that's exactly what happened to the NVA and the Viet Cong, who were essentially eliminated from the battlefield during this period by the South Vietnamese military and the United States military. So the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. But Nick just went back there. And so, Nick, talk to us. You went back there. How many times have you been back to Vietnam since you fought there in 1968?
Well, Mac, this was my third and likely final trip to Vietnam. My first one was for almost 13 months back in the day during the war. I brought my wife and my son in 1998, and we toured the areas that I had visited 50 years ago, and we really enjoyed that. We learned a little bit more about the culture of the Vietnamese people and visited these really interesting places. But at that time, it really hadn't changed much. There were a lot more people. Saigon was a lot bigger, but the area around Hue City just seemed to be pretty much the same as it was 50 years ago. On this trip, I've learned that Thomas Wolfe's statement, "You can't go home again," is very accurate, it's very true. And I feel like 50 years ago, a piece of my buttocks and part of my soul stayed in that country when I came home. When I visited it in 1998, it still stayed there. But this trip changed all of that for me. The amazing growth and robust capitalism that's going on right now in Vietnam has created a much different looking society and the ground that we were walking on. The Vietnamese people, I think one cool thing that we did in Vietnam is we taught them about capitalism. They're kind of natural salespeople, and they're not bashful. But today, as opposed to 50 years ago, and even I've heard 10 years ago, instead of being a nice, peaceful, exotic-looking place, the city of Hue is now this bustling, incredibly capitalistic place. where back in the day you had nice streets with trees on them, not a lot of hustle and bustle, folks living in substantial two-story houses. Today, those houses, almost every one of them inside the Citadel, are businesses on the ground floor of a wide variety, and the people live upstairs. So it was a bit jarring, but we found the places we wanted to see, and we learned an awful lot about what happened back in the day. I was blessed to have with me 14 Vietnam veterans and one younger guy who is a Marine veteran, but whose father had fought in Vietnam. And so we really had a reinforced rifle squad with us, plus a couple of really lovely ladies, wives, and one of my videographers, and my young niece went along for the ride as well. We were able to interview most of them, and what I was basically seeking is for them to tell us their story, and then at the end to just answer one question, and that was, 50 years later, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam? And so far, to a man, they stand right up and say, I'm damn proud of being a United States Marine, and I'm damn proud to be a Vietnam veteran. So hopefully, I think I've captured literally dozens of hours of film and thousands of photos with which I will begin to put together a proof of my planned documentary film that I will put out on YouTube. It's going to take a while for me to get up my arms around everything, but I'm very happy with the results of the trip, and I think everyone who participated in the trip is very happy that they went and they found what they were looking for. Our trip host is a group called Vietnam Battlefield Tours. They're awesome. It was formed by Vietnam veterans about 10 years ago. It's a nonprofit, and they go out of their way to make sure when they go on these tours, these return to their battlefield tours, that they make sure that every veteran sees what he came to see. They do an excellent job, and the trip itself was just terrific.
Wow. So I didn't know, I didn't realize that. I thought that was some private company that was making money doing tours that are going to take you to, you know, the big places. I had no idea that it was that nuanced and done by veterans. Wow. Awesome.
Yeah. No, these guys are a nonprofit, and I know there are other businesses and they do a good job, but these guys have, since their inception, actually hosted guys for free to go on these trips because they can't afford to go, but they really want to go and visit Vietnam. So they're totally nonprofit. None of the owners and guides get a dime in compensation. They just love to do it.
All right. So it's good to know you're all home now.
I'm home, 100%.
Adam, boy, it's only taken 50 years, so sometimes the better things, you have to wait on them a bit.
Well, they say time flies when you're having fun in the big city, so.
You know what, it was obviously a great day to meet you, Nick, down at Camp Pendleton, and Nick introduced me to his platoon sergeant, Mother Mullen.
And we called him Mother. He's actually Staff Sergeant John Mullen, U.S. Marine Corps, retired. He was medically retired because of his injuries suffered during the battle for Hue.
Living in Arizona and looks great. And I just want to thank you for introducing me to him and to all your friends. It was a great day for me. Thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Enjoyed having you there with us as well.
And my daughter was pretty impressed too, just so you know.
She should be impressed with you, Mac.
No, she's certainly not with that, I can tell you. That's the least impressive part of it. All right, Nick, the way we'll do this is we'll do an orientation. We'll talk about what your rank was, how long you'd been in Vietnam, and we'll just paint the visual pictures where you guys were operating. as we get going, and just a general orientation, and then we'll once we get done with that, and then we'll do kind of a transition phase of 1-5 en route to Hue, and then we'll talk about you guys in Hue, if that's all right.
That's fine. Sure.
All right. So let's do the orientation now. What rank were you? When did you get to Vietnam? How long had you been with Charlie Company 1-5? And what were you doing?
I arrived in the Republic of Vietnam on the 15th of November 1967 as a young, sort of salty second lieutenant. I had been an enlisted man for 9 months before I went to OCS in what's called the Enlisted Commissioning Program, so I guess I was a little salty because when I got to OCS, I knew how to blouse my trousers, which some of these college guys didn't. I felt that I could compete with them, even though they were wearing nice clothes and had nice looking hair. And so I basically went through the OCS, which is a 10-week program, at which time when you graduate, you're deemed to be an officer and a gentleman. Then the next step was the basic school, which was 21 weeks in my day. And that's where they teach you how to be a leader and how to be an officer and a gentleman. But for some reason, towards the end of that training, I was one of 11 of my classmates out of a class of 520 second lieutenants who did not fail the Army Language Aptitude Test. And I'm serious about that. Everybody else failed, except for 11 of us, and we were placed immediately into a high-intensity immersion language school to learn the Vietnamese language. It was 6 weeks, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, although I never really got the hang of the Vietnamese language, as I proved to myself that first day in country. It was beneficial to me because I was 6 weeks behind my peers. And reading the Army-Navy Times casualty list 4 weeks after my peers had gone to Vietnam, I realized and learned that already four of my classmates were dead. And some of those guys were outstanding leaders. They were good infantry officers. So it kind of brought me up short. And by the time I got to Vietnam, I was a little bit concerned that I might taking command of a platoon, which is about 50 Marines, that I might, out of my own inexperience, do or say something that would get somebody killed or maimed. I had the luck of the draw. I was assigned as a platoon commander in Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and when I reported in there, I was introduced to the staff sergeant, who was already running my platoon and had run my platoon for 2 months. So this guy, John Mother Mullen, knew the job. He knew the terrain. He knew what was going on in our area. And I took him aside and I asked him if he would please help me finish my training. So he, without the knowledge of our men, because it might have been a little bit uncomfortable for Marines to feel that their lieutenant was not 100% confident. But he basically put me through on-the-job training for about 3 weeks. He sent me out on night ambush patrols, day patrols, and he would hand me an M16 rifle and say, "Lieutenant, you listen to that corporal and you watch what he does." One of the best things that ever happened to me, and I'm grateful to him for that and for everything he did for us. So that was mid-November 1967. At that time, we were in an area called Hoi An, which was all about command detonated bombs, or IEDs, as the Marines call them today.
Right.
Booby traps. Okay. Sniper.
Okay. So just relative to the map that
sure.
that I have put up, you're headquartered out of Phu Bai.
Well, at that time, we were headquartered out of Hoi An, which is about 20 clicks south of Da Nang. Okay, so this is in November 1967.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
On Monday of this week, the USS Carl Vinson pulled into Da Nang Harbor.
Yes.
You had to see that picture with a smile on your face, yes?
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
We're talking about the aircraft carrier.
Yeah,
right?
The aircraft carrier pulling in. As you mentioned, Vietnam, very much a capitalist nation now. And I don't know, there's a greater symbol of capitalism than our aircraft carriers. But pretty interesting, as much as Korea is a boil, North Korea is a boil on our ass, I don't imagine the Chinese are extremely pleased, Vietnamese, when they look south and see the USS Carl Vinson in Da Nang Harbor. But I'm sure you had to look at it with a smile on your face.
Yeah, I thought that was ironic, actually. I think a lot of the things that happened today for us Vietnam veterans seem very ironic, and that's one of many.
All right, so I'm looking at the map. Charlie Company, south of Da Nang at An Hoi, and who are you fighting there?
Hoi An was the nest of Viet Cong. We never once saw a North Vietnamese Army soldier in that area. We saw very small groups, two or four guys that would hit us, shoot six bullets, and run. We would trip their command-detonated booby traps, and we were good at it. We were extremely good at it. I can tell you that when we left on Christmas Eve, 1967, we all were cheering because we didn't want anything to do with that TAOR. It was nasty. It was difficult. You could not tell friend or foe. And they were good at what they did. They hit us hard with our own dead ammo, artillery shells, bombs, and so forth, and they turned them back on us. I lost several good men in the middle of the night on several occasions as they were doing their night ambush patrols. A VC is out in the bushes with a detonating device and basically just blew them up. Then they run away, and you can't find them. So we were very happy to leave Hoi An, from which we went to an area called Phubai, which is just, Phulak 6, which is just south of Phubai, maybe 20 miles, something like that. And we just thought that was heaven for the first 2 weeks because we had a mountain stream, we could go get water easily, we could actually, a squad could go down there, put a couple of men on post as guards and go swimming in the river. And nobody was shooting at us. That all changed in early January as the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese Army and the VC that we didn't know at the time were ramping up to what would famously become the Tet Offensive of 1968. We were all happy to leave there too because it became Little DMB and Phu, literally surrounded on three sides by large mountains and right up next to a village on the other side. That combat base, which was the first time 5th Marines combat base during the height of that action in later January and early February, were taking as many as 1,000 rounds of incoming mortars, rockets, and recoilless rifle rounds. They never did assault us, ground assault, but they sure did a lot of damage.
Little Dien Bien Phu. So,
yep.
So, now, but unbeknownst to you, the Tet Offensive is ramping up. Keep going. As you're looking at the map, you'll go from Da Nang. If you go north, you'll see Phubai up along the coast. And
yeah.
So we're talking about that. And then way north, probably west northwest of Phubai. As you look at that. So talk to us about the initial parts of the Tet Offensive and where are you, what are you doing, and then when do you guys get orders to move?
Yeah, as most folks know, the Tet Offensive was launched in earnest early on the morning hours of the 31st of January, 1968. At that moment in time, Charlie Company was in Lang Co, which is a ways south of Phubai, guarding a critically important bridge of Highway 1, which was our only supply route. We either got supplies via helicopters or we got supplies from truck convoys driving up and down Highway 1. Our job was to protect the Haivan Pass and all of its bridges and culverts and that big bridge. If that big bridge had been blown, it would have taken months and months to replace, and there was no alternative route. Because it's a tidal bay, and you couldn't put pontoons across it, they would just wash out. The tidal changes were rather dramatic. So several of us, my platoon, were up on a bluff in the middle of the night on the 31st of January, and we watched as it seemed like the entire world was blowing up around us. No rounds were fired in our area. The only threat we had over the next 10 days was a little VC squad that were carrying a handheld 60-millimeter mortar. And they actually got fairly close to us when they were registering, but we called in a time on target, and that was the last we heard of them. So we were in Lanco. The battalion, most of the battalion, was still at that Fulak 6 combat base fighting for their lives. Delta Company was on a fire base just north of us, and we could see all that going on. But on the, I believe it was the 10th of February, we got orders that an Army unit would be replacing us. And Charlie Company got on CH-47 Army helicopters and took those into the major Fubai, combat base in Fubai. We were able to resupply. We had one meal in the mess hall, which was a little bit weird because there was a giant hole in the roof of the mess hall, been hit by rockets. But we resupplied, we got a hot meal, and the next day we went north on a truck convoy into the southern part of the city of Hue. The fighting had been going on in that part of Hue since the early morning, since the 31st of January, when a very understrength company of 1st Battalion 1st Marines, Alpha Company, got on a truck convoy and headed north to help relieve and reinforce the beleaguered Americans who were trying to defend the MACV compound, that stands for Military Advisory Command-Vietnam. It's a combined force of Army and Marines. I think there were even a couple of Navy officers who were naval gunfire guys. They had been under ground attack for hours and hours and hours, and the enemy was being relentless. It was the only place in the south part of Hue that was not completely overwhelmed and destroyed. But they held on, and the Marines of Alpha 1-1 got on that convoy. The truck drivers put the pedal to the metal, and they actually ran right through a gauntlet of NVA soldiers on both sides of the road and made it fairly intact to the MACD compound, reinforcing them, and over the next couple of days, helping to repel multiple enemy attacks. They were then reinforced by units from the 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, and that fight continued in the south part of the Hue. It's called the New City, for the next 2 weeks. It was house by house, room by room. And for the first 6 days, those guys had to fight under rules of engagement that were almost ridiculous in that they were overly restrictive. The people who, you know, Americans learning about this need to understand that Hue was probably the most important city. You still there, Mac?
Yep.
I got some stuff. Hue was probably the most important city in Vietnam from the point of view of their history and their culture. The university in Hue was attended by Ho Chi Minh, Vo Nguyen Gap, and many others in the North Vietnamese Army. It was the center of the Buddhist religion. It was a beautiful city. It used to be called the Pearl of the Orient, or the Paris of Southeast Asia. So I think you can kind of imagine what that place looked like. Over the first 6 days, the Marines of Alpha 1-1 and 2-5 were forced to fight against an overwhelmingly large enemy force with the tools they could carry into the battle. In their case, their battalion commander, who at the time was a senior major, his name is Ernie Cheatham, realized that because their rules of engagement prevented them from deploying any of the heavy support that we were used to using, no airstrikes, no artillery, no naval gunfire, and even though they had tanks with them, the tankers were under direct orders that they couldn't use their cannons. So Ernie, very early on in the battle, sent a team back south to Fubai, and they rounded up every 106mm recoilless rifle they could find and a bunch of mechanical mules. They mounted the recoilless rifles on the mules, drove them back north, and that became Ernie Cheatham's artillery, which he used to good order. But on the sixth day of that fight, they had not made much progress, despite the 106s, and they had taken a huge number of casualties. I think at that point in time, they had suffered 40% casualties. They were running out of Marines, and since everyone in the entire country of Republic of Vietnam was fighting for their lives at that point in time, because the enemy had successfully attacked over 100 cities, which was unprecedented, they basically were running out of Marines. But on that sixth day, there was a South Vietnamese colonel, who had been home for Tet, and taking advantage of the traditional Tet truce, which all the time leading up until that moment, both the North and the South and the Marines and the Army and the Navy had respected. There were a few incidents, but nothing big. This time, the NVA violated that truce and sent 85,000 soldiers from the mountains down into the cities. On that morning, that colonel had been hiding in his house, down in the basement, in the corner of his basement, for 6 days. When they overwhelmed the city, the NVA command group took possession of this man's house, and he couldn't move. He heard everything that was going on, knew exactly who those people were up in his house, but he couldn't move. He was afraid if he tried to run away, they'd just shoot him down. So sometime on the sixth day, he managed to escape. He approached the MACV compound with a stick with a white flag on it. And fortunately for him and for all of us, those guys defending the MACV compound let him in. There had been, leading up to that point in time, a few instances when an NVA soldier would go out and wave a white flag, and when the defenders relaxed and exposed themselves, then they would attack. So this time they let him in. And he immediately went to the officer in charge of the MACV compound and said, I know where the enemy command post is. It's right here. Showed him on the map. This is my house. Destroy my house and you will have cut off the head of the enemy. And they looked at him and they said, well, sir, I'm sorry, but we can't. And he said, what do you mean you can't? And he said, well, we're under orders, rules of engagement. We cannot use artillery or airstrikes or anything bigger than a small arms rifle or an M79 grenade launcher. So he said, well, please give me the radio. And he changed it to the 1st Arvin Division frequency, called the general inside the Citadel, explained the situation, and about an hour later, that gentleman's house was destroyed by the 1st Artillery Barrage, a friendly artillery barrage that had taken place during the entire fight for 6 days. That changed the dynamic, and at that point, the Marines were able to start rolling, fighting the way they had always fought, the way they had been trained, which is as a Marine Air Ground Task Force. When you're facing an enemy unit of any size, Marine Corps infantry doctrine basically says you secure it, meaning that you seal off the approaches to it, then you bomb the shit out of it, and you drop bombs on it, and you hit it with artillery, and you hit it with tank cannon fire, and when you have pounded that position, then you send in the infantry to clean it up. That's a doctrine. That's the way it's always been. But for some reason, and I guess the reason is they wanted to preserve these important buildings in the city of Wei, that was not the case for those first 6 days.
All right, Nick.
That changed it. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a few questions. Okay, so you guys are now, this is happening before you all get there, yes?
That's correct. This is the first 6 days of the fight on the south side of the river.
Okay, and so as people are looking at the map, so this fight's taking place on the south side of the river, and so I want you to describe, because we hear so much about the Imperial City.
Right? Yes.
Could you show us on the map, if I look at the MACV compound is number 5 on the map.
That's correct.
And that's Highway 1 that goes across the river that you guys have driven up from Fulak, yes?
That's correct.
All right, so explain to us what the Imperial City is, because in my mind's eye, I have this image of something that's maybe 3 blocks by 3 blocks that's a walled compound. Explain what the Imperial City is in Hue.
Okay. The north side of the river is what's called the Citadel Fortress of Wei. It is 3 kilometers on each side. So it's roughly 2.4 square miles. The walls on the outside of the citadel are built using the Vauban School of Fortress Building, which is the name of a French architect who was who lived back in the 18th and 19th centuries. This place was built in the early 19th century, 1805 through 1815, something like that. The outer walls of that fortress are about 25 feet high, and they're anywhere from 40 to 90 feet thick, depending on where you are on that wall. They were built using an outer wall and an inner wall, constructed with red clay bricks. And then they would just simply fill everything in between those two construction walls with dirt. So it was you could probably sit there with direct fire weapons and artillery and bombs for weeks and never really punch a hole in that thing. The Imperial City itself is a fortress within the fortress. And you'll see that square in the center of the southern part of the citadel.
Okay.
That was the seat of the Nguyen Dynasty emperors back in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. It was an amazing place. Those outer walls are approximately 12 feet high and anywhere from 4 to 6 feet thick. They're substantial walls, but not nearly like the outer walls of the entire citadel. The emperors resided there, his advisors, his concubines. They also had other estates outside that. But that is the single point of interest for the Vietnamese people. That's where their ancient leaders ruled. That's where the center of commerce is. And the center of the Buddhist religion is a pagoda, which is upstream about 5 miles. So, for those Americans listening to this and trying to learn about the importance of Wei City, consider that an enemy force has captured the cities of Washington, D.C., New York City, and Boston, and they are occupying it in force. That's essentially the situation on the ground after the NVA had launched their infamous Tet Offensive.
All right, so that helps me. So the Imperial City What are the appropriate terms then when we talk about whey? Because, you know, you hear the Perfume River talked about, you hear the bridges talked about, you hear the Imperial City, you hear the Citadel talked about. So how do you explain how you use them so that we can follow you?
Okay, going from south to north at the bottom of your map, everything south of the Perfume River is considered the new city. Okay?
Got it.
And a couple of notes here is when 1-1 and 2-5 got in there in the first day or two, the bridge, there was a bridge over a canal that served Highway 1, which is further south of your map. It was intact at that time. And the big bridge, the big bridge across the Perfume River was intact at that time. While they were fighting, the NVA blew that big bridge, and they also blew the smaller bridge. So that by the time we got there, the smaller bridge was blown, and we had to take a detour around it, and the big bridge was blown. And that was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. This was a huge bridge. And I don't know how many pounds of explosive they had to use to take that thing down, but it was down. There's nobody going across that bridge again. Now, the bridge is back built today, and there are now several bridges across that river. But on the second day of the fight, a unit from 2-5 were ordered to go across that bridge and enter the Citadel, which is the outer fortress. They didn't even make it off the bridge. They came under horrendous enemy gunfire from those high walls and took a lot of casualties and were beaten back. But they did get back across, back inside the MACV compound to safety. And that's when shortly thereafter they blew that bridge. So one of the things that I've learned about the NVA is a couple of things. Number one, they're dedicated and they're pretty doggone good fighters. I won't compare them to United States Marine, but they're pretty damn good. And they're good shots, and they are determined. And they fought oftentimes to the death. When we first got
Hold on. I'm still working on some of this stuff. Okay, so I can see the outer Citadel. And as I look at it, there looks like there's a river that goes around the outer Citadel.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's actually a canal.
A canal that goes around
the
outer.
Yeah, the river itself is the part that goes along the banks and goes out to the east and then comes back.
Got it.
All those square lines are constructed canals.
Okay, wow.
So those are actually navigable.
Okay, it's essentially a moat though. There's a moat, and then it looks like an area that there would have been roads around the edges, between the canal, between the moats and the wall of the Citadel, and then there's the wall of the Citadel, and then it looks like it looks like there's another canal inside the Citadel, and then what's the appropriate term? Is it the ancient city for that compound in kind of the southeast part of the Citadel?
Well, number 15 marks the Imperial, what I call the Imperial Palace.
Got it.
It's referred to on this map as the Imperial City. It's one and the same. And you'll see that around those walls is a moat. There is a moat on the outside of the Citadel Fortress's walls. That's all man-made. And yes, there is that inner canal that connects all of those moats together that runs right through the heart of the inside of the Citadel.
Whew, man. What a nightmare. I mean, honestly, when you look at the terrain, and again, Google Earth is the best. Because you can see the detail of it, how do you guys number the bridges as you go from on your map? There's two bridges, right? Actually, there's three.
Well, okay, so on the outer wall, on the Citadel Fortress wall,
right?
there are 10 entrances. There's two each on the east, north, and west walls.
Okay.
And there are four entrances on the south wall. The Vietnamese called them porches. We called them towers because there is a tower on top of that, but there's also a tunnel, if you will, through the wall in those 10 locations. And when they overran this city, they ended up with control of 9 out of 10 of those towers or entrances or porches. The only one that was held by the Arvins was number 10, which is right outside number 11, which is the 1st Arvin Division compound.
Got it.
And it is very intimidating, but consider this. What would have happened if they had secured that corner and that tower? How the hell are we going to do this? Not going to blow a hole in the wall. It's going to take way too long. You're basically faced with a hellebore insertion, which would have been very, very bloody. Because here's the thing. When we received our orders on the 12th of February, and I believe when 1-1 and 2-5 received their orders early in the battle, the estimate of the number of enemy in this area of operations was relatively low. There was so much chaos created on those first few days of the fight that our leaders, I believe, were kind of in chaos.
Right.
And they never really took a deep breath and paused and said, we really need to understand how many of them they are and where exactly they are. And that was never really accomplished. So as we often were throughout the entire war, as one rather famous major general, a fellow by the name of Ray Smith, said at a symposium, when I asked him to compare military intelligence today versus military intelligence in 1968, he kind of chuckled and he said, well, Nick, you know and I know that military intelligence in 1968 was we went down the road or the trail until we bumped into them, and then we knew exactly where they were. And that was the reality throughout this battle. We really never did have a handle on the numbers until the battle was over and in the aftermath. The estimate we were given in phase two was in that southeast corner, they estimated a couple 300 NVA soldiers. When in fact, and through study of history, we have learned that there were a total of 12,000 NVA soldiers that were committed to this one city. And about half of them were on the south side of the city, the river, and the other half were inside the citadel. So we were facing, the 2511 guys were facing 5,000 or 6,000 NVA soldiers in their area of responsibility. And they initially arrived, there was 150 Marines on that truck convoy. They were reinforced with another 150 or 200, and then another 150 or 200 over the course of 2 or 3 days. They never, ever increased their forces to the point where they outnumbered the enemy. Never did. But fortunately, once the rules of engagement were lifted, they were able to fight the way they had been trained to fight, with full use of supporting arms, and that made a huge difference.
All right. So I want to address, because one of the things that we hear is that you guys fighting the Viet Cong along the coast, essentially, as you guys got to Phu Bai, and were getting ready to turn around to go to Hue, that you guys were breaking out manuals about urban fighting. Talk to us about that period.
Well, to be honest with you, Mac, that's true. But to be honest with you, we didn't break out the manuals at all because we didn't have the manuals with us, first of all. But I do remember clearly that on the afternoon evening of the 12th of February, we're inside because we managed to sneak through that back gate. We're inside the 1st Arvin Division compound, and we finally receive our orders. And essentially our order said, attack and destroy the enemy forces holding the Citadel Fortress away. We were a battalion of about 1,000 guys. We were up against thousands and thousands of them that had been in there for 2 weeks preparing fighting positions. When I received my orders and when I received my rules of engagement, which essentially, again, 5-6 days after 2-5 had their rules of engagement changed because they're losing way too many Marines, we learned that we're going to start all over again because the rules of engagement said you cannot use artillery, airstrikes, heavy weapons of any kind. You're able to use an M79 grenade, which is a 40-millimeter grenade, sort of like a hand grenade. And our battalion, in recognition of our battalion commander, his 81-millimeter platoon, his 81-millimeter mortar platoon, carried in 11 tubes, and they were set up in that Mang Ka, that kind of funny-looking corner up in the northeast.
Yeah.
And they immediately began to, and against orders, I might add, they immediately began to target the enemy headquarters inside the Imperial City. But they did not use them as supporting arms for our attacks.
Okay.
So essentially, on the morning of the 13th, and through a series of...
Okay, hold on. Okay, hold on. So again, that kind of gets us through the orientation of when people refer to the Citadel, what they're talking about. When people refer to the Imperial Palace and then the canal and things like that. There's a series of canals. So now orient us to your map. Where do you guys enter the city? Do you guys come up from the south? You mentioned that your 81s were in the northeast corner. Kind of explain to us how you guys are arrayed as you guys move into the fight.
Okay. We made it by helicopter to Fubai.
Okay.
We resupplied, got a hot meal, and then we took trucks north on Highway 1. We made it to the first blown bridge, and we had to get off the trucks because the little bridge that we actually crossed, it would not have held up with a 6x truck loaded down. So we walked from that point into the MACV compound. We got there, and my company commander got his orders for the next step, which was to go to the stadium for additional resupply. At which time we were issued gas masks, which we had never been issued before, but they told us it was a threat of chemical warfare. So we had gas masks,
and on your map, number 6 is a stadium, yes?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah. All right. So you're in that general vicinity,
yes.
Kind of as an assembly area, getting ready to go.
Yeah, to my recall. That was the 11th of February, and we ended up spending the night on the south side of the river in people's houses. The Vietnamese people were there, and they welcomed us in because after dark, they would just crawl down into holes. So that was actually quite pleasant. We were sleeping with a roof over our heads for the first time in a long time, and it would be, it was just kind of bizarre. Next morning, we got on, there's a boat dock. It's listed as number 7 on your map there.
Got it.
And we loaded up on what are called LCUs, Landing Craft Utility. This is the very huge landing craft. You've seen the LCPs, Landing Craft Papa, which carry about 25 or 30 guys. You've seen pictures of the Mike boats, which carry about 50 guys. These LCUs, if it was just people, could probably carry 200 Marines, fully armed and packed.
Right.
But there wasn't that much room in that thing because it was loaded down. Before we even set foot inside, it was loaded down with high explosive ammo and 3.5-inch rocket launchers and LAWs and all that sort of thing. So we're sitting on about 4 feet of wooden crates with holding high explosives. There were about 100 of us from Charlie Company. We split up onto 2 LCUs, these landing craft utilities, and we sailed south on the Perfume River. And that was great because we didn't have to worry about too much, but sitting on high explosives, it was very unnerving to hear the first enemy mortar pop off of our right flank, off the east bank of the river. And if you've never been under mortar fire or artillery fire, your asshole puckers up and you hold your breath until something explodes. If that had hit any of our boats, we would have all been dead or badly wounded. Fortunately, although they bracketed us with their fourth round, we're the pedal to the metal, but these things only go about 10 knots. But the Navy personnel aboard that LCU had 50 caliber machine guns, and they started to really hose down the banks, and I think it eventually got to the enemy mortar team because their final round was way offline, and that was the last we heard from them.
Now, Nick, did you guys go straight across the river?
No.
Okay.
We went downstream, around the right side, if you see there.
Right.
We just made a right turn. We did not go across straight across the river because that part of the citadel was fully under enemy control. And they would have had the high ground, and we would have been slaughtered. So we go downstream, way around, until we get to point 9, which was like a ferry dock. They offloaded us, the big front ramp go down, and
right.
We got off, and they started carrying all the ammo and so forth. Until all of the companies from 1-5, with the exception of Delta Company, who had recently been attached to 2-5 down the south side of the river. So 3 companies in the battalion command group came by boat down the Perfume River to that ferry dock and offloaded. We then turned around, went back south, crossed that outside canal, and entered the back door of the Citadel Fortress. There was one funny little anecdote in that it happened that they wanted Charlie Company on point, and whenever Charlie Company was on point, my company commander said, "Charlie 1, you're on point." And so we were on point, for this movement, which was a pretty big movement, probably 500-600 guys. And yet, we then were told, "Wait, the battalion command group is going to take point."
Huh?
I guess our battalion commander didn't really think that I could find where I was supposed to go.
All right. So he took point.
So
you go to on your map, the place marked 9, and you dismount there, and now you're moving on foot. You cross a canal on foot. And now you're moving. You're on the south side of the canal in the northeast corner. Okay. And then we had
seen on our maps that we had to make that right hairpin turn.
Right.
Okay. At a certain point, I think it was like a few hundred meters south of that bridge. And I got to tell you, we went there. We basically went down the river just last month. We went down the river. We got off at the ferry dock. They had hired a bunch of Ciclos for us that we had, could sit in the front seat, and they were pedaling us from behind. When we missed that turn, it's hard to see. We completely missed the turn, and we missed the turn in February 12th, 1968. The battalion commander missed the turn, and he kept going.
Okay, I was going to say, so you see the initial arrow that goes to the south and then stops, and then and he was in charge of that, not you?
Yes, sir.
Attaboy. Good, that's good.
He wanted to take points, okay.
All right.
So my squad leader, who was a Lance Corporal by the name of Ed Estes, kind of looked at me with some funny looks on his face, and I said, "Look, just stay about 40 yards behind them and keep in touch and let me know how it goes." Well, we got past that point where we needed to make that sharp hairpin turn, and here comes that S just running back towards me, and he said, "Lieutenant, they missed the turn. They missed the turn." So he and I ran forward, and we finally caught up with them right there where that last little arrow is and that little crook.
Right.
And here they were. The Battalion CP group is not pretty to watch, okay? They're like a cluster. And there must have been 10 whip antennas, you know, the big tall ones surrounding the battalion commander and some of his staff. And there was one staff sergeant, I don't remember who he was, but he was kind of at the end of that cluster. And I ran up to him and pulled up my map and quietly said, "Staff Sergeant, you're in enemy territory." And it was really surreal because there were a whole bunch of Vietnamese civilians in and around that area just kind of looking at us like, "You people are crazy." Okay, so I just told them, I said, "You missed the turnoff. You need to turn them around and get them back up here." So he ran up, and fortunately nobody was hurt. They didn't shoot at us at that point in time. And we made it in to the Citadel at that northeast tower, which is identified as number 10 on your map. The number 11 is the 1st Arvin Division compound, which had been under attack for 12 days now. And it also included that Mang Ka, kind of funny-looking, five-sided, obelisk-looking thing, which is where the LZ was, the landing zone for medevac helicopters and resupplies, and it's where the 81 Mike mortar platoon was. We made it inside there. There's another funny little story in that Bob Thompson, who was our battalion commander, was pounding on the gate. These gates are enormous, and they're very thick, and they didn't want to let him in. So he basically said, "Well, I'm out here. I got a tank with me, and if you don't open the damn door, I'm going to blow it down." So they finally opened the door, and we snuck back in. We snuck in the back door.
Nice.
So you're asking about the fact that at that moment in time, the United States Marine Corps had done almost no training for what they called military operations on urban terrain or urban warfare. And when we received our orders that night and we received our rules of engagement, I have to confess to you that every one of my squad leaders, now these are E3s and E4s, are looking at me like saying, "You got to be fucking crazy, Lieutenant." And I said, "Well, yeah, I think it's crazy too, but it's our job. This is what we have to do." So at that point, I gathered my squad leaders around, and we talked about how much training we had received. And the average count from the enlisted guys was 2 hours. And my count was 4 hours, because I got 2 as an enlisted man, and I got 2 at the basic school. So we were basically totally inexperienced, untrained. But, you know, Marines adapt, improvise, overcome. So we pooled our knowledge, and we talked it through. We talked, how do we cross a street under fire? How do we enter a house? How do we clear a house without killing each other? And we talked it through the best we could for quite a few hours that night before we ended up taking off the next morning.
All right, so now we're I just want to review the rules of engagement and where you are.
Yes.
So you're located on your map at number 11 right now?
Correct.
Okay. So this is before you move into combat operations inside the Citadel in kind of the north end of the Citadel. Go with the rules of engagement one more time, Nick, just so everybody knows.
Our mission was to attack and destroy the enemy forces inside the Citadel of Hue. We were advised that there were about 2 companies of NVA, which would amount to about 300 guys, in our area of operations, which is that whole southeast corner. And we were then given our rules of engagement, which basically bluntly said, You may not use artillery. You may not use airstrikes. You may not use naval gunfire, which would have been problematic anyway because it's high-speed, low trajectory. And the tanks that will be with you tomorrow morning can use their machine guns, but they cannot fire their cannons. At that point in time, we did not have the Antos with us.
Okay,
we
stop.
Tell
everybody what the Antos is, because I think you just got a what the hell did he just say?
Yeah, right. Yeah, the Antos was lovingly called the pig by the Marines who came to love it and those who actually ran the things. A tank, an M48 tank, is a big beast, 60 tons, classic. It's actually called a Patton tank, and they look like what you were used to seeing during World War II movies, big, thick turret. Fairly slow. Those things could only go 20-25 miles an hour on a good day, but lots of firepower, but one at a time, one cannon round at a time. They also had a 50 caliber machine gun and a couple of 30 caliber machine guns, and they were good cover for advancing troops. You could get down behind them and be reasonably safe. The Antos is a different breed of cat. It is an armored vehicle. It's very fast. It could go like 45 miles an hour. It had very thin armor, something less than an inch. So an actual 30 caliber armor piercing round would go through that armor and kill somebody inside. But it was fast, and it was very maneuverable. And the most important thing is it carried six 106 millimeter recoilless rifles mounted on the roof. There were three on the left side in an inverted L, and three on the right side in the opposite inverted L. And these guys could shoot one of those tubes at a time, or they could flip a switch and pull the lanyard, and all six would go off. You had elevation. You actually maneuvered the Antos itself left and right, so you could really zero in, especially at the close ranges we were dealing with. So towards the third day of the fight inside the Citadel, when we got the Antoses, we evolved into...
Okay, hold on. We haven't even got to day one yet.
Oh, I was just going to tell you about the killer teams.
Okay, if you've ever been to 29 Palms,
yeah.
Okay, those Marines listening, when you drive into 29 Palms, when you drive into Main Side, you'll see a bunch of vehicles on the left-hand side. Okay.
Yes.
The Antos is one of them. It's a small kind of sports car looking track vehicle, right? Small. It's kind of a triangle tipped on its side. And you see the six tubes three on each side. That's what he's talking about. All right. That's what Nick is talking about. And so if you can imagine having six 105, you know, tubes that you can get down narrow streets and things like that. That was what the Antos was. And one of my master sergeants when I was a lieutenant had been an Antos driver gunner, right? There was only one guy inside the vehicle, right? He was a driver?
No, there was a team of three.
Inside? All of them inside?
Yeah, the commander, the driver, and the loader. But the loader, one of the hairy things about the Antos is, they're breech loaded, and the breech is not inside where you're protected. So when you exhausted your rounds, you had to go find someplace safe so the loader could climb out the back of it and reload those six tubes. It took a lot of balls for those Antos guys, believe me, but they got really good, and they knew that they had to just, you know, move fast and be quick.
You know, I asked him, did you ever volley fire that thing?
And we did, yeah, on several occasions inside the Citadel.
He told me, you know what, if you volley fired them, I mean, literally, you'd get knocked out inside the vehicle. He said, you can imagine the concussion that went off times six, and you sitting in the middle of it. And I want to say that he told me that there was a way that they would remote that. And I can't remember. I can't remember because the conversation took place in like 1986. But he said, yeah, six of those tubes going off about what, 2 or 3 feet away from you. Yeah, you'll never forget that. But he said it was just, it was an incredible, you know, incredibly deadly weapon. And for that fight, how big was the Ontos for you guys?
Oh, it's huge.
Right.
And what we ended up evolving into were these killer teams, which was an M48 tank matched and paired up with an Ontos. So the tank would rumble forward, put 3 or 4 or 5 cannon rounds into a target, and then start reversing back, and the Ontos would just come hauling ass up, screech to a halt, and end up destroying the position.
Wow.
Either one round at a time or all six.
You know, it's amazing.
And it would take a 2-story house and reduce it to rubble with one fire of those 6 rounds.
You know, it's amazing, Nick. You know, on Iwo Jima, they married up an engineer squad with a flame tank. And then the grunts provided the local security. And then they throw an armored bulldozer in there at times as well as a way to reduce caves. So, you know, it's almost the same concept going on in Hawaii, kind of a very adaptive, organization, finds what works and then goes ahead and begins to implement that. Interesting.
Yeah. Once they lifted the rules of engagement, that was probably our most effective tool, was a killer team.
Got it.
And we had several of them. Yep.
All right, so we're at the number 11 on the map, and the sun's coming up on D1. What's the strength of your platoon?
13 February 1968, I had 51 Marines, including myself, 3 Navy corpsmen, my platoon sergeant, and I don't think I had a right guide, so, and 2 radio operators.
So you had 51 total. With 3 Navy,
yep.
With 3 Navy enlisted. Wow.
Yep.
All right. So, talk to us about we know what the ROE was. You guys, begin to move south. Where do you make your first contact relative to the map?
I want to add one more thing about the Ontos. The most dangerous part of that thing or any recoilless rifle is the back blast zone. It's actually a kill zone. If you're within 40 meters behind one of those when it goes off, you're either going to be badly injured or dead. So you had to be real careful when you're maneuvering around that you don't end up with Marines in your back blast zone. Anyway, I just wanted to say that.
No, you know what? His name was Master Sergeant Mount, Top Mount.
Mount, M-O-U-N-T.
And he is a good guy. I love baseball. And he talked about that happened to them on more than one occasion when they'd be buttoned up. And the grunts around them knew that they were going to shoot, and everybody cleared away. Somebody who wasn't in the mix either was running to them to tell them something, but he said in his year of Vietnam, it happened twice that somebody ran up and got in the back blast area and was literally killed by the concussion.
Yep.
Well. Okay, go ahead, Nick. Let me reset. My guest graciously today is Nick War. He was a platoon commander with 1st Platoon. Charlie Company.
First platoon. Charlie 1.
In Hue City in January, February of 1968 during the Tet Offensive. So we've been talking about it this morning, kind of done a pretty detailed orientation, tracked Charlie 1-5's movement into the north end of the city, and as the sun comes up on February 13th, one Marine officer, 47 Marine enlisted and 3 Navy enlisted as they cross the line of departure. Nick, what is the line of departure for you that morning? You're at number 11 on the map. Do you go into the fight just south of there, or do you move for a bit before you get engaged?
Well, our avenue of approach is that north-south street out of the 1st Armored Division compound. So our point of departure is that it is their front gate, essentially. Uh-huh. We move straight south about, a click until we get to the street that's marked 12, which was our line of departure. At that point, at that point, first thing in the morning, the order in March was Alpha Company was on point.
Love that.
They had two tanks with them, and Charlie Company followed after them, and Bravo Company was still inside the Arvin compound as reserve. The plan was for Alpha Company to move up to that line of departure, make a left turn, and deploy east. And at that point, which is number 12, they then were planning to make a right turn, move forward. They put some troops up on the wall. They got up on the wall, at least one squad, maybe a couple. But unfortunately, the company commander of Alpha Company decided to have a powwow with his command group.
Right.
And a couple of his platoon commanders, and just after they turned that corner, they were clustered around the front of one of those tanks, and a barrage of B-40 rockets and RPG-7s hit that tank and wiped out the command group, Alpha Company command group, killed the company commander, badly wounded the executive officer. I think there were maybe a dozen casualties as a result of that. It was not a smart move. And it essentially cut the head off of Alpha Company. They had no leaders. So they called the guys back down off the wall. This all took place about 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning on the 13th. And at that point in time, I was at that intersection of the avenue of approach and the line of departure. And I could see down that street, and I saw the RPGs hitting, and of course, heard the yelling and screaming over the radio nets.
Okay, so let me stop. Let me stop you.
Sure.
All right. What's the? It looks from your map like that's all green space between your assembly area as you go southward along that canal, or you cross one canal. It looks like a library and something else. Is that all open space, or is that all buildings? Describe
what you mean. Most of it is, most of it up in that part, there are estates.
Oh, okay.
There are big houses with large yards with low fences around, concrete fences, maybe 3-4 feet high. So no, there are quite a few houses. The map is a little deceptive because it does not show any buildings to speak of. But those spaces were nicely filled in 1968. Today they're just cram-packed, but they're nicely filled. They were beautiful estates. They're nice walls, gardens. It was kind of surreal that we're going to be fighting in this situation.
Okay, so essentially, so it's kind of interesting that you guys enter through that northeast corner, and then you don't make contact till you get down to the back side of really the, you know, you're past kind of the midway part of the citadel, and you're in the southern third of the citadel before you actually make contact down, right? Interesting.
It is a little odd to think of, but keep in mind that since February 1st, when the 3rd Arvin Parachute Battalion reached Hue and reinforced the 1st Arvin Division compound, saving it, that unit had been fighting the NVA every single day. So they had met the enemy, they had had many, many battles. I think that the NVA decided to leverage the high ground down in our corner, which is that Dongba Tower, which is number 14 on your map. And so they pulled everybody back.
Okay, hold on. I'm not finding 14. I see 12, 13. That must be 14.
Okay.
It's a bridge?
It's a tower. It's on the right side there.
Okay. And
it's
on top of that bridge that goes over one of the inner canals?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay.
Well, no. The bridge enters the gate. The bridge across the outside moat enters through the gate, through the wall. And the gate is above it, so it's slightly too far right. But if you'll see, there's a black blob on the left edge of the circle, 14.
Yes, yes. Okay.
That's the tower.
Okay.
And that's called the Dongba Tower. That was the high ground throughout the entire battle.
That area right there at 14,
yep.
just a little bit west of 14.
Yep. And they were up there in force. And they had the high grounds. And the number 13 is, it's actually in green. It was dubbed Phase Line Green. The next street south of it is Phase Line Orange, and the next street south of that is Phase Line Black. So that street, it's called Mai Duc Long. It's the name of some general, I guess, from Vietnamese history, was our front line on that day. And actually, it was our front line for four solid days.
Okay. All right. So walk us through, you know, we've done all this to get to this point, which is Charlie Company moves into, Charlie One moves into action. Walk us through, what you guys did that, it's approaching midday, right?
It's really about 10 or 10:30 in the morning, maybe 11, might be as late as 11. When Alpha Company pulled back after they had lost their, leadership corps, we were then ordered to become, the point attack unit. They pulled a platoon from Bravo Company out of reserve and fed them into that narrow block, which would be on my left flank. My platoon had that first big street. Third platoon had the next one to my right, and second platoon had the next one to their right. So that entire line from the north-south street just outside the Imperial City until almost the Dong Ba Tower, that's all Charlie Company TAOR on the first day.
Okay.
And I just got the luck of the draw, as they say, and I was designated the maneuver element or the attacking force for the first attack. First, we had to clear the buildings between the line of departure and Phase Line Green. My men proceeded. They were being very thorough. They were being very deliberate, practicing on-the-job training of how to cross the street and clear a room, clear a building. And we made it all the way through, as did the other two platoons to my right, until we got to Phase Line Green.
All right.
And as I've reported in my book, one of the things I regret and will always regret is that I had not communicated effectively to my Marines, my squad leaders. I assumed something. I assumed that since they were battle-hardened, seasoned veterans, that when I said, go to Phase Line Green and wait for orders, that they would do so by taking up positions of cover and concealment. So you can imagine my amazement as I walked out the front door of the home whose address was 72 Mai Duc Long Street, which was the very center. And I looked left and I looked right and saw my men all out in the streets, kind of crouching down, looking around a 8-inch diameter tree when we were looking at a matrix of NVA soldiers, which I estimate there were at least 200 of them in just my block. We didn't know that until the shit hit the fan. And my immortal famous last words were to scream just before they started shooting, to scream, get the fuck out of the street. And just in that first firefight, I lost two killed and several wounded, a couple down in the street. For some crazy reason, I turned right and ran through a hail of gunfire. My radio operator, Benny Benware, was right on my ass, as he always was. And we ran those 90 yards until we got to the corner, at which time a Lance Corporal who was in front of me was shot and his body knocked down a gate, and we all piled into a little corner courtyard with some cover at the point. At that point, from that point on, it was chaos for the entire day. That's when Mother Mullen went down. He was on the left flank. I was in the middle, and one of my squad leaders was on my right flank, moving south. And what happened with John is that during that first burst, during that first firefight, three of our guys were wounded badly and down in the street. And when John saw it, he just went to work. He ran out in the street under fire, grabbed the first one, drug him back in that room, went out under fire a second time, grabbed the second one, drug him back in that house. And then as he was going out to get the third guy, an RPG-7 came from kitty corner across that intersection. It missed his head by about 6 inches. He still has the burns on the back of his neck to prove it.
I saw him.
Exploded in the back wall of that corner room and threw him out in the middle of the street. At which time, the NVA shot him in the head. When I finally caught up with everything during that initial engagement, my corpsman, Doc John Loudermilk, who was the best, had given him immediate aid. He actually had to put the side of John's head and his ear back on his head because his brain was exposed, wrapped him up, got him going to the rear for medevac. And when I saw Doc John, he just looked at me and said he's not going to make it, Lieutenant. He didn't think there was any chance. But fortunately, in those days, our supply line of medical support was very, very solid. They got him to Fubai at First Med for quick surgery, and then they got him aboard the USS, the hospital ship, where he got additional surgery. Didn't recover consciousness for 11 days, and when he did, he was at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. He spent a year there recovering from traumatic brain injury. And today he has no sight in his left eye and no hearing in his left ear, but he's still larger than life. And what's amazing to me is I always just assumed that 13 February 1968 was the worst day of John Mullen's life. But when I met him many, many years later, I said that to him. He said, no, Lieutenant. It was a year later when they kicked me out of the Marine Corps. His long-term life goal was to be the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. He loved the Corps. And I'm so blessed that he was doing my job when I first got there, and he took me through the ringer. And after 3 or 4 weeks, he said, okay, you're ready, Lieutenant. That's the smartest thing I ever did in my life. And I think it saved a lot of people because, I mean, I just wonder at that, you know, my greatest fear in Vietnam wasn't for myself. It was for me doing something stupid that would hurt one of my men. So,
Nick, okay,
that was...
Let me stop you. Is 13 approximately where Staff Sergeant Mullen is wounded?
No, where the 13 number is, that's
yes.
My right flank.
That's your right.
He was on the left corner.
Okay, so he's closer to 14?
He's at the intersection about halfway, two-thirds of the way between 13 and 14.
Got it. All right.
He's in that corner house. And you can see by the map, Mac, that the dozens of NVA soldiers carrying automatic and semi-automatic rifles and machine guns up on that tower.
Oh, my God.
Had us zeroed in. And one of the terrible things I learned after our first attempt at assault, a little later after our first attempt at assaulting across that street, was the Bravo Company platoon that was supposed to have my left flank secured was not in position. They were about 50 yards back behind some houses, so they had no field to fire. And I couldn't figure out why I'm getting all this gunfire from my left flank. So, basically, as the story unfolds, after we recover,
Okay, hold on. I don't want you to unfold it anymore yet.
Okay.
So, what time is it now?
I'm thinking it's a little bit before noon.
Okay, so just in the space of 90 minutes, you have 2 KIA, Mullen, who you've been told is not going to make it. Your platoon sergeant's down. Who replaces Mullen before you go? And did you guys know where the gunfire was coming from? Because a lot of times, you know, in movies and stuff, people see it's like somebody shoots and everybody goes, oh, they're over there. But in the real world, finding them, where is it coming from, is not as easy as all that. How long did it take you to identify where that stuff was coming from?
About 2 nanoseconds.
Oh, it did. You right away.
Yeah. Unfortunately for us, it was not hard to figure out because we were 25 paces away from NVA soldiers who occupied every door, every window on both levels and roofs and fighting holes dug between the houses. It was like a matrix of automatic rifle fire staring us right down the throat. So, no. And it was also coming from our left flank. I knew it was coming from that damn tower. And it was also coming from across the street in front of Charlie 3, who was in the next block over to my right.
Okay.
So, no, I had no problem identifying where we were taking fire from. We were taking fire from everywhere in front of us.
How, so, Nick, you're the platoon commander, right? And as much as you want to stop and take time for any of this, you can't because it's unfolding in front of you more. What do you do? Do you appoint a new platoon sergeant right away, or do you just keep going and fighting? Talk to us about what happened next.
Well, I probably should have, but I didn't. One of the challenges we faced there, in addition to the rules of engagement, in addition to a very well-armed and determined enemy right across the street from us, was communications. When we went in the way, I had a PRC-25, and John Mullen had a PRC-25. We both had personal radio operators. And each squad leader carried the PRC-6. We called it the Prick-6, which was like a giant walkie-talkie that was about as useful as a boat anchor as a communications device in a built-up area. We learned almost immediately that they just didn't fucking work. So they got jettisoned, and now I've got communications with one other side of my platoon. So what I decided to do once we, the corpsmen were patching guys up frantically, and I realized I don't have control of my men, I decided to be my own runner. And for the entire rest of that day, I went from right side. There was an alley. There's an alley that you can see clearly on the map behind Phase Line Green. And that alley was quite substantial in 1968. It's completely gone now. It's just covered with houses. But I ran from that right-hand corner, right where it says 13, just a little to the right, back to the alley. Ran into the center house where I had originally gone through, talked to Estes for a while, who was frantic because he had 2 Marines down in the street wounded. They could hear him screaming, and he just had to get his buddy. Charlie Morgan was one of his best friends, and he's one of the guys down in the street. And there's a whole story there, but then I ran back to the alley and went to the squad where Mullen was. That's when I talked to Doc Loudermilk, who then came with me back to the center, and we watched Ed Estes lose his mind. He lost his mind. He had to just go help Charlie. Ran right out into a fusillade of enemy gunfire, got to Charlie, but wasn't able to lift him up because he had been shot in the neck. And he came back in, blood spewing out of his Adam's apple. And he fell down at our feet and died in Doc Loudermilk's arms. So for the entire rest of that day, during which time we were ordered three times to carry out frontal assaults on the enemy positions right across the street from us, I was my own runner. That's all I could do. I couldn't communicate. So
okay, so now, Nick, you guys are still, the axis of attack is south, right? But you're taking essentially enfilade fire from the flank.
That's right.
And Bravo Company's not in position to deal with that yet.
That's correct. It was, Mac, it was a hell. It was just this terrible hell. Part of it was my frustration over the rules of engagement, with which I made myself very clear to hire. I must have screamed and yelled at Scott Nelson dozens of times that day. And he swears that he screamed and yelled at battalions those same dozens of times. And the order came three times. It's your job. Attack. We tried it three different ways. I believe the first way was we established two squads as a base of fire and rushed the other squad across. That didn't work. We tried it the next time. These are about an hour, hour and a half between instances.
Okay.
Where we rushed one fire team from each squad across. That didn't work. And all it did was result in death for us. And I'm sure we killed some of the NVA because the return gunfire was good. The fire discipline was good. But if you just stepped a little funny, you'd get shot because, you know, the front windows were glass and you could see right into the living rooms. And I saw that several times. I was talking to one of my squad leaders and there's a Marine standing next to him and all of a sudden he's shot in the stomach, like 2 feet from us, through a catty corner door. And another guy who was in that front room where Ed died, were in the midst of that when I saw him get shot in the chest through a window. So it was very difficult to stay in a position of cover and concealment and yet at the same time address the enemy and try to get at him.
All right, so you try three variations of that frontal attack, of that frontal attack south across Phase Line Green, and there's just too many of them on all three occasions. At what point does somebody make a decision? Does somebody, does Alpha Company take the lead and they try it?
Not that day.
So it was that day, and then after your third attempt, it was shut down?
After my third attempt, which failed, we actually got two guys across the street, but they were immediately pinned down by NVA soldiers who were probably 10 feet in front of them. They were down behind, there were a lot of concrete walls, you know, 3 feet high kind of thing, and they made it across the street, but they were down on their faces making love with the concrete, and the NVA were shooting right over their heads. One of them was Sergeant John Erskine, who was carrying the PRIP 26, and I called him and I said, "You just stay there until dark." And both of them, he was able to kind of communicate with the other guys, so they just stayed small until after dark and then they crawled back. That's what we tried, but I told Iyer every damn time, I said, "All you're doing is getting my men killed. This ain't gonna work. This is not gonna work. This is completely in defiance of military strategy and tactics that we had been pounded into our head all during our training."
But the other thing, Nick, that's pounded in your head is you're a Marine, right?
Yes, sir.
And when this shit gets rough, what do? We tighten our chin straps, we tighten our belts, and we fucking get after it, right? So between somebody who's on a radio who really doesn't understand what's going on down on the street and the long shadow of the Iwo Jima monument, you're there as a leader of Marines trying to make sense.
Well, let me be honest with you, okay?
Okay.
when I received the rules of engagement and the orders the evening before, I knew in my heart and I knew in my mind that this was fucking crazy. I knew it. I believe everybody above me in the chain of command, if they'd understood the situation, would know that as well. I can tell you that my squad leaders knew it was crazy because they told me. Those guys were not bashful, okay? So I had a decision to make. I had two choices. Number one, disobey and defy my orders.
Right.
At which time, I would have lost my commission, I would have lost my command, and I'd be labeled as a coward for the rest of my life. Number two is give the damn orders and pray for the best. And that's what I did, and I have to live with that the rest of my life, because I know that that was a form of insanity, especially in light of the historic fact that just a week before, the guys fighting on the south side of the river had been under those same rules of engagement, had suffered horrendous casualties, and had made very little progress with those same ROE. And now here we are today, and somehow somebody up in higher thinks, oh, well, they can do it. You know, it didn't work out so good the first time, but, you know, let's just try it again. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the most important lesson of this battle for our young Marines. And one of the things I'm very grateful for is that the initially the Infantry Officer Corps folks, and this was supported by the Marine Corps University and eventually became part of the many different training programs there are for urban warfare, is they created a decision-making exercise for young leaders. This has been taught to second lieutenants in the basic school. It's been taught to second lieutenants who are in the infantry officers course. It's been taught at the small unit leaders course in both Camp Pendleton and Camp Lejeune. And I've had the great pleasure of monitoring these and watching them and contributing as these young guys learn. And essentially what they do, Mac, is they bring the sergeant or they bring the lieutenant into a room all by himself. They give him exactly my orders on the 13th of February and my ROE. And it takes them 15, 20 minutes to brief the lieutenant. And then they say to the lieutenant, okay, what do you do now, lieutenant?
What do you do now?
And every single person that's gone through this without knowing what it's about says, well, that would never fucking happen. That's stupid. It's completely in defiance of infantry tactics and strategies and how we do business as a Marine Corps. And they basically then say, well, not only could it happen, but it did happen here. Read this book. And they hand them my book, okay? And it's just the best thing that's ever come out of this. To know that as both a veteran and an author that these young Marines and the leaders truly study history and they apply those lessons. I was told personally by General Jim Mattis and General Conway after OIF, the first Operation Iraqi Freedom, that the rules of engagement were heavily influenced by my book and by the lessons learned white paper that we have given to literally hundreds of different American military units. There was a huge debate that took place during the ramp up of OIF. And there were, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but just about every significant command that go into battle these days has lawyers with them.
Oh, no. Yeah. Let me just tell you, I haven't worked for General Mattis, and, you know, you see the absolute importance of the ROE.
Yeah.
And again, I talk about it. You know, the Marine Corps has this thing about, we, you know, keep your honor clean. And you do that because you have to live with what you do for the rest of your life.
Right.
You have to do, okay, but there's also a balance between that. You have the absolute, not only right, but responsibility to defend your command. And so, yep. And so you should care just about as much about your command as you do about civilians. And you do everything you can, and Nick, we've lived this. You do everything you command under your, in your power to make sure that nobody that's innocent pays, you know, for something that they didn't do and they didn't wish upon anybody. But at the same time, you have a moral obligation to the families of your Marines to bring them back. And so you have to balance that. And so, no, the ROE, it's not easy. And I think we pay a lot more attention to it now than I think people did in the past. And I think we do that because we've learned hard lessons like the ones you're, the one you're talking about that you lived on a daily basis. And those decision-making exercises are absolutely critical in the education of our lieutenants and our young leaders. And that's why I'm, that's why this is another version of it, Nick. And it's, and again, I can't thank you enough for doing it. Talk to us about, the sun goes down that day. What's your final casualty count for the day?
Let me just interject one more thing on ROE and about, you know, obeying orders and all that sort of thing, because I think it's really important. I want people to know that I am not advocating mutiny on the battlefield. Okay. Once the, there's two, basically two general phases of any military operation. There's the planning phase and the execution phase. In the planning phase, and I have lectured this many, many times, whose job is it to establish and confirm the rules of engagement? And I'll get, you know, almost all the time they go, well, that's the company commander or the battalion commander. I said, no, it's your responsibility. You're in a damn safe environment. You're, all you're doing is talking, and you know the terms. Sir, with all due respect, sir, this is fucked up. Okay.
I always say, hey, look, you better shut up because I know whatever's coming out of your mouth after that is going to be disrespectful. So be very careful.
I know, but respect, you know, and it's just that here's the reality is that on the 12th of February, none of us leaders, none of my company commander, all the platoon commanders did that. None of us sounded off.
Okay. Yeah, but Nick, I don't think you do that until you have an experience like you have, because you're not experienced enough. You believe
that
right? What everybody's telling you is true. Did you have any idea that morning that about what you would hit at Phase Line Green? Did you have an idea that you would hit something that substantial? Because what you're describing is literally hell on earth for an infantry leader in that it's coming from everywhere. And you're trying to make up or down, you know, you're trying to make heads or tail of it, and it continues to come, and you don't.
Mac, let me just say that if this had been the first part of the battle for Wei, you'd be absolutely right.
Yeah, but
this
you weren't.
You
weren't at the Battle of Wei. If I apply your standard to other people, I absolutely agree with you, but I don't agree with you applying it to yourself. Because you didn't participate in the initial part of the battle. You come in later.
But we knew about it. We knew everything about it.
All right.
You cannot stamp out the rumor mill, okay? You just can't. And people learn about this, and they talk, and they tell each other, this is what happened in the south side of Wei City. And it was a bloodbath until they got it right.
Okay.
And here we are a week later. And they're telling us, oh, there's a couple 300 guys when they knew full well, they knew that there were thousands and thousands of them. Okay. So, look, I appreciate you wanting to.
No, let me tell you, I'm
not
doing that for you, but I think sometimes what we do is in hindsight, we'll apply a standard that is not realistic for when you're, instead of looking at it in the rearview mirror, when you're looking at it through the windshield, it's a different view. And so if you knew that going in, then I understand your comments. But a lot of times people will apply a tough standard to them, and they really didn't know that going in. They had heard about it, right? But they didn't really know that, and so I think there's a difference. But I'm not trying to get you off the hook for your own. I'm not trying to rescue you. Yeah. These are the things that that combat leaders wrestle with, right? Every fucking fire team leader in the world wrestles with this, and you go up the food chain. It's just a bigger wrestling match on a broader scale. So
I agree with you wholeheartedly there, and I appreciate your view on that.
No, and you know what? That's why this show is so fucking good, because it speaks to that. You know, I have a friend of mine who's been on the program. His name is Jeremiah Workman, recipient of the Navy Cross in Fallujah. They killed 20.
Yeah, I know that name.
Yeah, they killed 24 guys, but he can't get over the fact that they lost 3.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, and he says there's not a day. If you ever want to listen to an interesting interview, go to the podcast page and just type in Workman and start on part one.
I will do that.
He said there's not a day in my life that I don't get up and think, what could I have done different? How could I have got there faster? Because, you know, if I'd have got there faster, maybe they'd be alive today. You know, and so
let me share one sure. more thing. I always listen to the old salts. I love Sergeants Major and I love First Sergeants, especially the gunnies. And when we were all together getting our orders that evening, one of the things that Scott Nelson told us, and by the way, he was great. He was one of the best natural leaders I've ever had the pleasure of working with. But he's delivering the orders, and we're listening to him. And one of the last things that he said was, and oh, by the way, we want you to leave your packs back here so that way you can move faster and hit hard, and we'll be done by tonight. Okay? We're all thinking, yeah, right. But I looked over at the gunny who's sitting down there eating some canned peaches, and he looks up at me and he says, I don't know about you, asshole, but I'm taking my fucking pack. Okay. It's like, okay. You know, that was wisdom. That guy knew. But you're right. You know, I mean, it was something that we were going to have to do one way or the other. I just, you know, I feel like that hire should have had more wisdom and understood that this needed to be a Marine Air Ground Task Force approach.
Right.
And
so let me ask you, in the hindsight of 50 years, I'm sure you've been able to have conversations with people.
Oh, many.
Okay. Why the fuck did the ROE go back to what it was prior to getting smart on the south side of the river?
That's the $64 million question, and I don't know the answer. Except,
oh, for crying out loud, Nick. How can you not have that answer 50 years later, for God's sake? That's what you're on, that's what you're on the damn program for. So,
okay, here's my lame-o answer, Mac.
All right.
I think the Tet Offensive took the South Vietnamese leadership and the American leadership completely by surprise. Now, there were some guys that say, oh, we kind of figured something big was coming. But there was no national alert. We're in the middle of a truce. Westmoreland and everybody else had been saying, hey, the light at the end of the tunnel is getting brighter. We're making progress. We're killing a lot more of them than they're killing us. That's been going on now for months leading up to this point.
Right.
I believe, this is my answer, they were embarrassed. LBJ and McNamara were completely blown away.
No relation.
I know.
I'll just
call him strange. How's that?
No relation. Yes.
I know.
I'm okay.
But anyway, I truly believe, if you want me to take a guess at why they would have done that, it was simply that embarrassment. And they were in a damn hurry. They were running around with their hair on fire, trying to figure out how to do this. And that's what led them to do that very stupid thing.
You know what I thought you were going to say?
What?
What I thought you were going to say was, Mac, when you go inside the walls of the Citadel and you get near the Imperial Palace, the Imperial City, you are talking about kind of the Holy of Holies of Vietnam.
Yes.
And so what we weren't able to do, they thought they might be able to do again. And that was the rationale behind it. That's what I thought you were going to say.
Okay. Well.
Oh shit! So there you go. There goes that one.
I think LBJ and McNamara were pissed off and embarrassed, and they just kept throwing us into the breach. Without a lot of thought. But fortunately, those ROE were finally reversed on the 16th. We got our first artillery strike late the night before, about 11:30 the night before. Five rounds of 155.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
The next question I have for you is, at some point when this thing begins to die down, you look around and you see that, again, from our previous conversation, you have 29 dog tags in your pocket. Talk to us about what that was like, how it impacted you, and at the end of day one here for you in Hawaii City.
Okay. When I've looked back on that day, which I've done many, many hundreds of times over the years, the first thing I will tell you is that I was a profoundly changed person from what I was that morning until what I was that evening. I became kind of a shell of myself. I was still functional. I was still, this happened probably between the first and the second abortive assault across the street. I was so numb by everything that had happened up till that point. And I didn't know, but I, you know, realized that a lot more was to come that day, but I wasn't able to do anything for at least a minute or two or maybe 10 or 15 minutes. I don't have any recollection, but I went back into the back of that house, found a rocking chair and sat down and just numbed out. I went back to my days as a kid in my head, and I probably would have been there the rest of my life until Benwer came to me and said, "Lieutenant, Hire wants you. You're ordering another attack." And when I got up out of that chair, I was a completely, profoundly changed person. I had become an automaton. I could deal with orders, and I could give orders. But I no longer wanted to know these great young men. I didn't want to know their names. I didn't want to know where they're from. I didn't want to know if they were married or single or had a girlfriend or what high school they went to. I did not want to know anything about those guys because the guys I had already lost. I mean, I was a lieutenant and they were enlisted guys and they followed my orders every time I gave them. But I had gotten to know him, and I had learned that, for example, Ed Estes, you know, had a girlfriend and wrote him a Dear John letter. You learn those things, and you see someone like that go down hard. It's just the hardest thing in your entire life. So that was the first thing. I probably did not realize that at the time. It probably took me many years to reach that point where I can look back on it and say for sure that changed my life, that moment, those hours that were in there. I have also, you might find this as strange, but I've also come to realize that there was a real good chance that I would have been killed in a way had they done it the right way. Okay? Had they done the prep fires, had they, you know, given us direct firing weapons and so forth and so on, because the life expectancy of a second lieutenant in combat, not very long. You have to be kind of lucky. I made it through that whole thing and my entire tour without a scratch on my body. I don't know how that happened. I was probably over that 13 months, I was probably in hundreds of firefights and in this one instance during the entire battle for Hawaii City. I was in that shit all day long, every single day for, you know, 2 weeks. So, the other thing I will share with you is when I'm sitting there with those dog tags, and I received my orders for the night, which was to fall back a half a block, take up positions of cover and concealment, one up, one down, that I was told that the next morning I'm going to take half my Marines and give them to the 2nd Platoon, and the other half and give them to the 3rd Platoon. So essentially, although this is kind of humorous, you know, in Mark Bowden's book, Way, 1968, he finished this chapter by saying that I had effectively been demoted, okay? And I just kind of laughed at that because Bowden obviously doesn't know a lot about military matters. Like, you know, it's impossible to demote a 2nd Lieutenant, you know, or in the bottom of the barrel. But the way I put it is that my job was rather viciously and bloodily eliminated, okay? That's the way I look at it. But when I basically then reported the next morning back to my company commander and started working with the gunny to help the other platoons and the other companies, I was completely numb. I didn't want to think about it. Just whatever you want me to do, I'll do. You know, put me where you want me to be. Over the next 2 days, that single block that my platoon had the responsibility for was loaded up with both Alpha and Bravo Company. So you got 400 guys instead of 50. And yet it took the courage, the gut-wrenching courage of one Lance Corporal to make the difference to get across that damn street the first time and establish a beachhead after many, many casualties from both Bravo and Alpha. So, you know, I guess, you know, looking back on it right now, I'm very grateful, obviously, that I survived that. I don't see myself as a warrior. I see myself more as a citizen soldier. But I think my purpose in life is to have been a witness, and I am doing everything I can to make sure that the history of that battle is factual, you know, warts and all. I don't give a shit if it makes IR look bad. They made themselves look bad by not paying attention to what happened in the first 2 weeks and issuing those same orders and the same ROE. And I've decided I'm speaking out. I'm going to tell the truth. And that's always been my goal. I think people who have read my books know that that's where I'm coming from. I don't care how I look either. I'm not here to be some famous hero.
So let me ask you, Nick.
Yeah.
So when they eliminated 1st Platoon, was it because of the casualties that you guys had suffered that day?
Yeah, we're only 22 of us left, and three are corpsmen. Me and my radio operator. So essentially there's 17 fighters, okay?
Right.
And that's not nearly enough to be a significant maneuver element. I didn't question the order. It honestly made sense to me. It broke my heart, but it made sense to me that, yeah, we're not big enough to be able to do much of anything, you know, if we have to do another assault across the street like that. So, yeah, that was their reasoning, and I think their reasoning was correct. Essentially, it was Scott Nelson who made that decision. And, I don't question that at all.
So your Marines, they go to those two other platoons. Is 1st Platoon ever reconstituted in the fight? Okay,
we didn't get reinforcements until the very bitter end. We got, after we had actually left the Citadel, I got 5 new Marines, who were real green, okay. I mean, they were green. No, they were reconstituted. When I got out of the Citadel, and made it back to Fubai, my company first sergeant taught Stanford. handed me two things. He said, Lieutenant, here's your regular commission papers. Your ass now belongs to the Marine Corps. And I said, well, give me those, Tom. And I shredded them. And I said, what's the other thing? He said, I got a ticket here for you. You got to get to Da Nang tomorrow. You're going to Sydney, Australia. And at that point, I basically said, absolutely. You know, top Stanford was really a classic Marine for a sergeant. He really, when I first got in country, he scared the shit out of me, honestly. I was always trying to salute him. And, but he was the classic first sergeant. He did such an outstanding job of taking care of his troops. So, you know, I went to Sydney, Australia for 6 days. Don't remember a thing other than I imbibed quite often. And I think I got a little bit of a breath. And then when I got back in mid-March, they had rebuilt my platoon, and I took command again at that point. But no, it was done. Charlie 1 was gone. And it stayed that way until mid-March.
Nick War, my guest, and the book is called Baseline Green. And if you look at the map that goes with this segment, you can understand what the book is about. Is there ever a day that goes by, Nick, that you don't think about this?
Not one single day, Mac.
You know, and I think that one of the things I hope that people who listen, especially young leaders that listen, know that you're going to be changed by the things that you see and the things that happen to you, and that's okay.
Yep.
You belong now to the class of men and women on this planet that are warriors. And whether Nick considers himself one or not is irrelevant. He's part of that tribe because you're changed forever. And the fact that this stuff bothers you, it's okay. You can't go through this stuff without this stuff sticking to you. You're not chrome, right? You're a human being.
Yep.
With all the pores that go with that. And so I just find it you're just, Nick, another example of a leader that joined the Marine Corps from someplace in the United States that got sent, and then lo and behold, fate puts them in a place that's excruciating in terms of what it requires from a leader. And you're expected to lead in those circumstances. And, oh, by the way, then you're expected to live with it for the rest of your life. And so why is it important to keep your honor clean? Because you do have to live with it. Why is it important to train hard and be good? Because you do have to live with it. You know, and again, I it's a stupid quote, but Maximus's quote in Gladiator, what we do in life echoes in eternity, is absolutely positively true. And I know it's a stupid movie, but there's sometimes things in movies that get your attention. And I will tell you this, that got my attention in that movie, because it's absolutely true. Nick, as you began to kind of digest this over the course of the years, what's been the most difficult part of this, for you to digest as a leader?
Well, first of all, it became when I kind of got all my memories back about 25 years ago.
It took that long?
Yeah.
Wow.
I worked with people for 25 years and they had no clue that I was a Marine, let alone a Vietnam veteran. The human mind is an amazing place.
Right.
And when you go through stuff like this, you're quite capable of tucking those memories down very deep inside as though they're not there. It didn't happen. And I actually went through some therapy with a very good psychologist who spent 6 months talking to me twice a week. And we got from my childhood to my adulthood. And when I left, years later, I realized that lady does not know I'm a Vietnam veteran. Okay, so it was totally buried, and when I decided that I needed to get this story off my chest, that I needed to start sharing with others, it was very, very, very difficult in the early stages. It's become a lot easier these days because I I put myself in a position to reach out to the Marine Corps and say, hey, I strongly believe that those of us veterans who have experienced these things have a duty to come and work with the young guys so they can learn this stuff in a nice air-conditioned classroom rather out in the sands of the Middle East or anywhere else. So that was probably the most difficult thing, and yet it has become one of the most rewarding things in my life because I just kept kicking my own ass saying, you got to do this. And I have been fortunate that I've had a lot of feedback on that book from guys who fought in Fallujah and Ramadi and other places, and they bought the book because it was on the Marine reading list for 10 years, and they're studying it, they're reading it, you know, the 2 days before Fallujah, and learning about what happened to us, keeping that all in balance. I want to say a couple more things, Mac, if we've got a little bit more time.
No, we do.
Go quick.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead. I mean, it's your it's your time, not mine. I don't give a shit if you're late.
Yeah, okay. Here's the thing. Over the years, I've been in many, many professional military educational seminars. I call them leadership symposiums, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to the grunts, talking to the basic school, the IOC units, and so forth. And on a couple of occasions, after I've told this same story, I've had guys, you know, kind of sitting in the rear of the room in civilian clothes who are Marine Corps veterans. And one guy basically stood up and challenged me. He says, it sounds like you really got a problem with my Marine Corps. And I took a deep breath and I said, look, first of all, every word in that book is mine. I accept the responsibility for everything that's in that book, and I would not change a word. Number two, I want you to know that I love the United States Marine Corps, okay? Despite all of my bitching, griping, and complaining, that's hindsight, you know? And I think it's important that we're honest about this stuff, because if we're going to try to teach young Marines the realities of combat and we're telling lies, that's just absolute folly. So I just wanted to get that out to your listeners that I am so proud that I served in the Marine Corps during a time in our history that was extremely challenging and made it through, okay? And I'm very proud of the fact that when I get together with my Marines at reunions, they all come up to me and hug me and say, LT, it's great to see you. How you doing? You know, and it's like the first time I went to a reunion, I thought I was going to get my ass kicked a dozen times because of the orders that I had to give in those circumstances. So, I just wanted to make that very clear that I feel determined and bound to telling the truth about what I saw and what I experienced and what I did and what I didn't do. I've had lots of conversations along those lines with many of my fellow Vietnam veterans, and we've come to learn, and I believe I believe most Vietnam combat veterans would agree with me, that although we went to Vietnam with a noble purpose, we went there to help people, yet it was a flawed undertaking, starting from the very top with our leaders, and the, you know, civilian leaders, and even some in our chain of command. But I just think it's stupid to try to really help today's Marines understand what they're going to be facing on the battlefield by telling a bunch of fibs. Because we can make somebody, you know, because we don't want to disrespect some lieutenant colonel or you know, whatever.
Well, you know, Nick, I'll just say this. I think you have a moral obligation to speak the truth, and then the chips can fall where they may. People don't like it. You want to hang around afterwards. We can argue about it. Okay.
Yep.
But you have a moral obligation to young people that will go and fight to tell them the truth about your experience. And to me, if you guys who won't do that for their own reasons, okay, I got it. But I think that I was amazed in when I started teaching the decision-making stuff that they teach at IOC. I taught the first decision-making class there. I went to John Allen and said, we don't teach a whole lot about decision-making, and I think it hurts. They don't know it's okay to be confused. They don't know that in that confusion they have to act anyway, okay? And they have to get comfortable doing that. And so, to me, we have a moral obligation to talk about it. Why was I telling lieutenants for the first time that when you get mortared, right, or you get machine gunned, and you get the shit scared out of you, you might puke, you might piss your pants, or you might shit your pants, and that's a normal reaction as your body blasts itself with adrenaline.
Yep.
Why didn't anybody teach me that? I was pissed. Why didn't guys who experienced that in World War II, Korea, or Vietnam tell me so that when I had those feelings, I wouldn't be thinking about, God, am I a chicken shit? You know, I'm so scared. Why would I know that? And so you absolutely positively have to. And if somebody gets their feelings hurt, the only reason you can get your feelings hurt is if you didn't do the right thing.
Yep.
If you tried and you made a mistake, everybody has to live with that. And that's what's hard about this shit. And that's why it's important that we talk about it. So,
I like your points there, Mac, because I've thought about this a lot too, that in my experience during training, boot camp, and all the way through the basic school, leading up to going to combat, I never saw a World War II or Korean War veteran. They had a couple of docents in the MCRD San Diego Museum, but they were just pointing out dates and times and names and stuff like that. You know, and this is what we call the greatest generation. Right. And I love those guys, okay? I really do. But I think during our war, they stayed the silent majority. I think those guys could have done a lot more for us and come, spent time, and told us the truth about what happens in bloody combat. And it didn't happen. So in my conversations with my fellow Vietnam veterans, we recognized that it was a noble but flawed undertaking, that we made lots of mistakes. And it's our duty, it's our obligation to pass that information on to this younger generation, who I view as being outstanding.
You know, one last comment, Nick, and I'll let you go.
Yes.
I think the reason a lot of this is able to happen now is because of the strides we've made in post-combat related mental health.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that if, you know, World War II, veterans came home and they did what everybody did before them. Wall that shit off. Don't go there.
Yeah, they did.
You know, don't go back into the dark places because it's you're going to stay up for nights. You're going to conjure up the ghosts, and you don't, as somebody told Jeremiah Workman, Jeremiah, keep those monkeys in the cage, man. You don't want to get those monkeys running around your head. It makes life hell. That's the oral tradition of post-combat related mental health. I received it when, you know, after a Huey helicopter crash in 29 Palms, pilots decapitated, co-pilots crushed to death. Two other Marines are trying to live. You're trying to save them and everybody's dying. And I have somebody walk up to me and says, you know, you're never going to get over this. What the fuck does that mean? Why would you say that to me? Because it's the truth and you need to know it.
Yep.
But it was the best advice I ever got in my life. And so whenever that stuff bothers me, I know that it's not abnormal. I know that it's okay.
Sure.
And so I think had we had better mental health, that those guys would have opened up. But the way we used to do it is to wall it off. And it's what most of you guys did too, right? You talked about 25 years, right? That's a pretty decent stucco job that you did on that shit.
Yeah, but the problem is all of that's up there in your mind and it's fucking you up. You've got to let it out. You just got to get to a point where you let it out and you share this with others And sometimes that's really hard to do because you start to share your memories with people that really don't understand. I call it the eyeballs rolling around in the socket syndrome.
Right.
You can tell immediately they don't believe a word you're saying.
Right,
you know?
And then that means it's time to get the hell out of there, right? Okay, stop. Never mind.
Never mind.
Nothing to see here. Gotta go. See you later. Yep. My guest, Nick War, will continue this visit right after this. On a Wednesday edition, the second installment of Battlefield Studies, we're talking about Huey and one of the first platoons of 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, to make contact on February 13th of 1968. More of Nick War coming up next.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the soft community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue, and our battle study today, we've been talking about the battle for Huey City. And the author of Phase Line Green, Nick Warr has been gracious enough to spend some time with us again. So, Nick, first of all, before we go any further, thanks for giving as much of your time as you've given to this little project. I appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure, Mac. I enjoy talking to you, and if we can help save one Marine's life, I'm all for it.
All right. So we've been talking about this for close to 2 hours and I think 10 minutes now. The lessons learned portion. Over the course of 50 years, you've blocked it out for about 25, but in the other 25, you said a little bit earlier, which is pretty common, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about this. Talk to us about the lessons learned.
Well, obviously, we've had a lot of time to think about it, Mac, and several of us were invited shortly after my first book was published, and we were invited to come to Camp Pendleton and work with the leadership of the 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, who were the first Marine Infantry Battalion to go through full-scale urban warfare training. They called it Urban Warrior, and it actually began in 1998-1999. And in preparation for that event, six of us put together a white paper we call Lessons Learned Operation Way City. There are a lot of things that we did wrong from my perspective looking back on it 50 years ago. But there were seven significant things that we feel could have been greatly improved at that time during that fight. You want me to just start ticking them off?
Yeah, and just so everybody knows, these lessons learned are going to be attached to this podcast. So when you see it up on the website, you'll see the words lessons learned. There'll be a hyperlink from that, and that will lead you to this document. So just so everybody knows, it's out there, and we'll make sure it's in the post. All you got to do is click on that hyperlink, and boom, it'll take you there. So with that said, Nick, go ahead.
Okay, the first point is focuses on rules of engagement. One of the things that I learned 20 years ago, getting back in touch with the Marine Corps and spending time with the young Marines and their leaders, is that the Marine Corps developed a set of leadership principles and traits that they use to really try to improve young officers' ability to make decisions. The traits are outstanding, but the principles, my first point here having to do with rules of engagement applies to principle number 11, which basically says, employ your command in accordance with its capabilities. It's a very short sentence, but it's also a very profound sentence. There's a lot of meaning to it. Essentially what that means is a Marine leader, whether it's a fire team leader, squad leader, platoon commander, all the way up the chain of command, needs to know for sure what his Marines can do and what they can't do under a certain set of circumstances. Now, Marines are hard chargers, and if you tell them to do a frontal assault against an overwhelming force without supporting arms, I can attest to the fact that they'll get up there and they'll do their best. But I knew at that moment in time when we received our orders, and I certainly knew towards the end of that first day in battle, that we did not have the ability to accomplish our mission without getting completely destroyed. So leaders need to understand their ability, and they also need to understand their limits. And in that particular case, which I think is probably the most important point here in terms of lessons learned, we got a big F because it took a total of 4 days, full days of all-out bloody urban warfare to just simply get across the first damn street and establish a beachhead. Because we were doing this without supporting arms, which is completely contrary to military theory in terms of urban warfare or any other kind of warfare. We were taught going up against reinforced bunkers, hardened positions against just the VC up in the mountains, that if you came across an enemy position with, say, a squad in it, and they had built it up, they had logs in front of them, they were very well camouflaged, first of all, you needed to put in your side a force 3 to 4 times their size. Number two, you had to pound that position with whatever direct fire and indirect fire weapons that you have at your disposal in terms of heavy support. Number three, try to flank them rather than trying to do a frontal assault. But number four, then you send the Marine infantrymen in to finish up the job. We could not do any of that.
Okay.
It was an engagement.
All right, let me
ahead.
I hope you don't mind if I interrupt. You did that.
No.
Okay. You did that, and you raised, as a leader, you're listening to an order, and there's a lot of things that we do in the Marine Corps that we simply violate, you know, the things that we advertise. You know, numerical superiority and things like that are we defy on a routine basis, right? And you know our attitude is we're going to get this done, and so I would my question is this: you're a young leader, you're sitting there and you're listening to an order, and it puts your unit in a position where it may get destroyed. Now, you don't think it's going to happen because we never think that's going to happen to us. But you're looking at it, and your eyebrows come together, and you think, holy shit, right? This is not going to go well for us. What do you do then, Nick? I mean, because at the end of the day, right, we follow orders and we get it done. Is your moral obligation to put your hand up, to look somebody in the face and say, hey, sir, I don't think this is going to work. I think you're going to get this order gets my platoon annihilated. Is that your moral obligation? And if he looks at you and says, hey, Lieutenant, I got it, right? But this is where we're going. This is what we're doing. Button on your chin strap. Let's go. Is that your moral obligation?
Yes, it is. I truly believe that.
Okay.
And I want to make one distinction, Mac, because when we got our orders, we were in the planning phase of this operation. That was the evening of the 12th of February.
Okay.
We weren't in the streets. Nobody was shooting at us. That would be the execution phase. You can't do anything like that when you're in the fight. It's too late. It has to take place during the planning phase. And we should have all of us who knew, based on just our own training and our understanding of fighting in Vietnam, we knew that this was outrageous. It was just not going to happen. So the way you have to do it, had we not been so indoctrinated that you get an order, you got to carry it out, there's no choice, there's no discussion, just go do it. The opening sentence is always the famous, with all due respect, sir, please consider this. It didn't work 2 weeks ago. Why do you think it's going to work today? So that was my failure. It was the failure of every one of my fellow platoon commanders, my company commander, my battalion commander. No one pushed back. No one. Not even during the training, the planning phase. So that was in my mind, it was a huge failure in leadership, because we knew, I knew, all my squad leaders knew, that given these orders and given these rules of engagement, we were not employing our command in accordance to its capabilities. We knew it. I knew it. And I got to live with that for the rest of my life, but it's okay because it's a lesson for today.
All right. All right, so the bottom line is, if you think you've been given an order that doesn't use your unit commensurate with its capabilities and doesn't use the firepower at your disposal to mitigate any concerns, your moral obligation is to raise that point. And so yeah. The thing that you live with is not raising the point, because ultimately if I'm the company commander and I've been told to shut up and color because I raise the same points and you raise it to me and I look at you and say, hey, Nick, I got it, okay? But I got told to shut up and color, so I'm going to give you the same response, shut up and color. And at that point you say, yeah. Yes, sir, right? But your point is you have to live with you, so you've got to raise the issue.
Yes.
Okay. All right. It's not, and because we all know it's not a democracy. Somebody got to give orders, and it doesn't happen. Sometimes, you know, I mean, I last night I was reading about Lieutenant Colonel Cheatham, you know, putting together Ontoses with 106s and grabbing gas masks. You said, you know, you guys didn't even carry those around. Things that he knew that they would need down at Fubai, he was gathering those things to take north to Hue, so they you all would have the things, you know, that you needed, and that simply were not organic given the fight that you were currently fighting, and so, you know, a lot of times we're not configured to in the optimum condition to do some of these things, and you have to dance with who you brought. But at the same time, there's a balancing piece, and that is the intellectual part of this. And I don't even think you need to say with all due respect, because there's no need to be disrespectful. We're professionals. You just look and say, hey, sir, question. You know,
that's the phrase we used back in the 60s.
Right. No, you still hear it all the time. But my point is this, we're professionals. Right, it's not disrespectful to ask a hard question. I would tell you, it's your moral obligation when you take that oath, and other people's lives depend on your decision. You've got to ask that, and any leader who gets asked that from a subordinate should not look at it as disrespect. He should look at it, and he's a good leader. He's questioning this because our asses are hanging out, and he'd be stupid not to. So anyway, all right, on to number two.
Okay, this has to do with intelligence gathering. We honestly did not know. We knew there were a bunch of them inside the Citadel. We knew that there had to be thousands of them. In our briefing, we were told there were at least two NBA companies, which would have added up to about 350 or 400 fighters. But I knew from what had happened on the south side of the river in the past 2 weeks, there were a hell of a lot more of them than we were being told inside of our orders. So, not knowing exactly where they were was a real big challenge. There was supposed to be a hookup after we left the 1st Arvin Division compound. Our battalion commander, our company commanders were supposed to hook up with the leadership of the 3rd Arvin Parachute Battalion, who'd been inside the Citadel and fighting for about 12 days. They certainly knew exactly where those guys were. They would have certainly known where the high ground was and that the Dongba Tower was bristling with enemy and automatic weapons and rockets and all kinds of stuff. So that, for some strange reason, and we don't really understand why, that never happened. At that point, a small unit, or preferably a recon unit, should have gone forward, snuck forward, peeked, and found and seen where the concentration of the enemy were. That never happened. I have a good friend named Ray Smith. He retired as a 2-star general, and I asked him that question after he got back from Iraq and wrote his book. I asked him to compare military intelligence in 1968 versus military intelligence in 2003. And he kind of chuckled and he said, well, you know, in 1968, we would go down the trail or up the road. And when we ran into them, we knew exactly where they were. He said military intelligence in the present century was a lot better. In the Operation Iraqi Freedom and the fights for Fallujah and Ramadi, they had not only the eye in the sky kind of intelligence assets, but they had human assets, and they had identified exactly where the command and control centers were and where all the troops were before they ever fired the first round. So again, and I think this is because of the embarrassment of our leadership that the thing had happened in the first place. They were just in a very big rush to get the job over with. So we did not take the time to let's slow down and let's see if we can figure out exactly where they were, which would have helped a lot.
It's hard to believe, Nick, that you didn't do, in your forward passage of lines, you didn't do something that's pretty fundamental to the forward passage of lines, which is a battle handover, and that is the exchange of information between COCs, between frontline leaders that are going to take the same sector before you know the unit that you're relieving leaves. That's pretty amazing. It probably gives you right. I mean, you talked about units that were overwhelmed and fighting that was very, very difficult. But that's a pretty. I mean, guys, you guys doing it for the first time? Yes. I mean, fighting like this for the first time. And
that's right. And
I don't want to make excuses for anybody because that is a pretty fundamental. You know, hey, before you guys leave. My company commanders are going to be in here. Your company commanders need to be in here, right? We need to have the translators so that we can pass information and look at maps. Everybody got that? Pound the table and let's set a time. Pretty basic yep. In terms of operations. Okay, number three.
This has to do with communications, inter-unit communications and intra-unit communications. You know, in 1968, we had the ANPRC-6 and the ANPRC-25. We called them the PRC-6 and the PRC-25. The PRC-6 worked pretty well out in the paddies and even sometimes in the jungle, but it had a range of about a click. The PRC-25 was much better, but we learned the hard way on that first morning that the PRC-6s were a complete waste of time. You could not talk to another person in the next room, let alone in the next house. They were completely useless. So in my case, rather than being able to talk to my three squad leaders on a regular basis, I was only able to talk to the other half of my platoon, which was my platoon sergeant. And when he went down, that became even more difficult. It broke down in my particular instance. Mac, to be being my own runner. In order to make sure that my squad leaders, my leaders were up to speed with what was going on and what was being expected of them, I basically decided since I was not an active fighter, I was carrying around a rusty .45 caliber pistol. I didn't start carrying an M16 until late in the battle, that I would just have to run back and forth and update my squad leaders on a kind of a 15-minute to 30-minute basis. I understand today that the communications capabilities and all the technology that today's Marine Corps has is an order of magnitude better than what we had to deal with. But a lot of it's based on technology, and I only get really worried because I spent 30 years in technology, and that's an area where Murphy's Law rules. When in Murphy's Law says something's going to go wrong, and it will go wrong at the absolute worst time. And so whenever I visit Marine Corps and other military units, I ask them about that. And I also ask them, when you're doing the training with all this whiz-bang technology, do you ever turn it off and say, now what do you do, Lieutenant? What do you do, Sergeant? What do you do, Corporal? Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. They have a great faith in that technology. But we know there's weapons out there that they can take that down in a heartbeat. So you might have to fall back to runners and the old Mark 101 compass to make your way around. I think I speak for all Vietnam veterans as we would have just given our left eyeball to have just GPS back in the 60s and the 70s. But a GPS device is no good if it doesn't work. So communications is fundamentally critical.
Nick, the Commandant just probably within the last month and just went out of his way to make the comment that given the electronic warfare and that it appears that the training that the Marine Corps is now doing is for a near-peer contest in which the battlefield will be level. and they will have the same capabilities we have, that those technological devices will be, to a certain extent, either negated, degraded, or taken away completely, and you better know how to navigate. You better know how to do it without, you know, your squad radio, because it very possibly could be taken away from you. So interesting. And so I get your point, and I'll tell you an Afghanistan story. Mike Arcamo loved me in Afghanistan. In my third deployment, I was doing something for the third time, and I had a pretty good handle on it. And so running a combat operations center for the 1st Marine Regiment, when COM went down, I never got pissed at the COMO, you know, because we just became a Vietnam COC. We did it with green gear. We did it with yellow canaries. We did it with push pins. We could do everything we were required to do, and it was good for us to do that. We did not miss a beat. We didn't miss clearing fires. We didn't miss anything. You know, you just get reliant on we now have chat rooms that we communicate in, right? So Battalion TAC 1 is a chat room in which everybody can see the dialogue that's going on. And so, and there's great benefits to it, and it can go sometimes too fast. But when for instance, you know, you have microwave shots, so when the wind blows, the dishes move, and pretty soon you don't have any network because of the movement of the dishes, and they can't sync up, and you can't move data. And, well, guess what? Green gear works, and we can do it like that. So I think it's fundamental to training to shut those systems off on a regular basis and go without. Are you still able to lead an attack, to push an attack using a base unit as opposed to your and now, I mean, consider this, Nick, you have communications with your squad leaders, and you know the Marine Corps is getting suppressors for all its infantry weapons, so it's going to be a quieter place. I mean, so your command and your ability to control, you know, goes, you know, compared to what you experienced, through the roof, right? Yet, you got to work on doing it without that. So you develop the muscles you need to develop. So in the attack, when you lose comm, all you do is you grab the base unit, right? And the outside, your outside, or the squads that aren't the base unit as a platoon commander, they know what you're going to do. I know what he's going to do. He's just going to drive the base unit, and I've got to move off them. I can do that. We've rehearsed that. So point well made. Yep. Point well made. What's the number?
I want to tell you, Mac, that I'm really pleased that General Miller has his eyes wide open, because that's a really important issue.
It is. To be able to just to develop the muscles, the technology is awesome. And you know, I'm sure you've seen the articles. We have drones now down to the squad level, down to the platoon level. You know, so you can see what's in front of you. The question is, what happens when they either jam them, or yours won't fly, or you didn't get battery resupply for it, and it's not worth shit anymore. What now, man? Yeah. As you point out. All right, what's number four?
Okay, number four is really it's improved supporting fire plans because of our rules of engagement. We did not have a supporting fire plan because we had no access to heavy weapons. But let's say for a moment that they did give us that. One of the challenges that we would have faced, even right from the beginning, is danger close. Urban warfare in most cities, especially in third world countries, is really, really tight. Your enemy is across the street, and these are not wide boulevards. These are typically narrow two-lane streets with maybe a curb on both sides. And so calling in a fire mission with, let's say, 155s, which are pretty accurate these days, is still pretty dangerous to friendly troops. But speaking as a combat veteran who had to do without that heavy support completely, I would take danger close over nothing any day. You know, they can call us and say, here it comes, so we expect, we get down, and even 25 meters away from the explosions, the enemy is going to take it a lot harder than we are, and all we have to do is get our heads down behind some kind of position of cover. And there was plenty of that in Way City.
And I might add, and now with the precision-guided munitions that we have, and I think one of the smarter things that we've done in recent years is we've even made our some of our munitions smaller, so you don't have to worry about collateral damage as much, and you can, you know, which window do you want me to fly this thing through? You know, I mean, you know, you can be pretty accurate with them, depending on if you're lasing for them or if you're, you know, if you're using GPS technology or sometimes the pilot's lasing. So, pretty accurate. But your point, Nick, is, and there's a way to walk that stuff back into the target where you're starting a little bit further out and bringing it back towards you as opposed to maybe trying to hit it the first time. That way you make sure, that way you make sure it's safe. So there's techniques and procedures that you can do to use that. But, the whole notion of danger close is, and danger close is different in a city. I mean, I think we define danger close in peacetime as anything less than 1,000 meters, in combat less than 600 meters. But when you're in a city, if it's more than a block away, it might be not what you're facing in terms of across the street, but the next block, you know, the next block isn't really danger close. You know, this is the block I'm looking at. That's danger close. So it even that's changes right. When you get inside of the city. And Nick, I neglected to ask you, and I want to, what was the distance across the street of Phase Line Green?
From door to door, it was exactly 24 paces. I paced it off back in 1998. I was just curious. I knew it was close. But basically 25 yards.
25 yards. All right.
From door to door, from window to window, from roof to roof.
All right. Lesson number 5.
This has to do with training and practice. Up until that moment in time, the last time Marines fought in urban warfare was in the Battle for Seoul. And it was brief, but it was bloody. I believe that the North Koreans, who had gone almost all the way down to the tip of the Korean Peninsula, realized they were in danger of being cut off if they tried to hold Seoul, because we had made that landing at Incheon, and they really wanted to get out of Dodge, but it was still tough. So in Vietnam, this is a guerrilla war. This is basically hit and run, VC here, sniper there, booby trap there, and an occasional large battle with a large enemy force. Those battles were usually created by the hit and run tactic and the enemy's knowledge that Marines pursue. So they would hit and they would run in a direction that they wanted us to go into. And they would hit and run and hit and run until the NVA regiment leader felt he had the right ground, and then they would stand and fight. So that happened repeatedly throughout the Vietnam War, especially in the first half, and up until Operation Way City, we had never been in anything more than a rural ville or, say, a small town. It just had not happened. So at that moment in time, and as I think I shared with you on the night of the 12th, once we all calmed down and realized these are our orders, this is how we're going to have to do the fight, we talked through this. I took a poll of my squad leaders, and they had each received 2 hours of training in urban warfare. In my training, I had received 4, because I'd been an enlisted man for part of the time and an officer the other part of the time. Now, I know today, and it's terrific, that the Marine Corps has built many urban warfare centers. They got some tremendous training capabilities. But the point's not prepare for urban warfare. The point is you have to prepare for what you expect, and you have to prepare and train for what you least expect. You have to kind of get creative. What could it possibly be? What's the next thing that's going to happen? And be flexible enough to know your ship in terms of what you're expecting to have to do. Marines do that really well, okay? But you need to have probably little sessions where you sit around and say, what's the worst thing they can do to us? What are we going to see next?
you know, the whole IED thing, as I understand it, early in Iraq, being counter IED was kind of a circus where they would use a cell phone to be the detonator for a large amount of explosives. And as I understand it, the Americans and our allies developed a technology where they could fly over an area and be doing stuff technology-wise and blow those explosives up by simply sending messages to all cell phones, okay? So the enemy then adapted to using egg timers or using command det stuff, okay? So that's the sort of powwow, I think, or kind of group discussions or little seminars, is to not only think and train for what you do expect and what you are preparing for, but thinking about what could they do to us that would catch us off guard. But the importance is to be prepared and to be training so that when you get into that urban environment, one of the most wonderful things, Mac, that I've heard from returning veterans from Iraq, Afghanistan, anywhere in the Middle East, and I'll ask them, tell me what it was like. And they said, sir, it's just like our training, except for we're using live ammo. That's the epitome of training. Okay, so I highly commend the Marine Corps for that. I think they also need to be considering what other possible things are we going to have to face.
Okay, let me ask you, as you fought the Viet Cong down near the coast, after you would go on operations and you would finish, would you sit down with your squad leaders and would you have a, whatever you want to call it, an AR, a critique, a hot wash, whatever the hell you want to call it? Would you sit down and critique your own performances and talk about, is there anything we need to train on? Did you do that formally? Did you do it informally? What were you doing before you got there, Nick?
We called it a debriefing.
Okay.
But yes, if it was any kind of significant thing, or when a squad would go out on a night ambush patrol, and let's say it went well, nothing happened, you know, we would talk to that squad leader and say, okay, tell me what happened. What did you do right? What did you do wrong? What do you need to improve on? That's kind of an automatic thing, I think, in the military, especially in ground forces and the infantry, is you have to be constantly improving your gains.
Okay. And again, a lot of people think that, you know, when you go to quote-unquote combat, some of these things change. That ought to be a piece of everything that you do. And it gives your subordinates the opportunity to put their hand up and say, hey, sir, I don't get why we did this. And maybe there's something that didn't get communicated. Maybe you screwed something up. But that kind of intellectual, I think, openness lends itself to when you wind up in Hawaii and somebody gives you an order that and you don't get it. It gives your subordinates the freedom to look at you and say, just like they would in a debrief, say, hey, sir, question. Why in God's name aren't we blowing the shit out of those buildings before we go across the street?
Yep.
And so I think it's like raising kids. If you want them to come to you with their problems, you better be open and willing to deal with their problems when they're young and when they're little. Or else when they get older, they're sure as hell not coming, unless it's as a last resort. The same thing with young leaders. You got to create the environment that they feel comfortable looking up and not saying with all due respect, but questioning what we're doing here today. And it gives you an opportunity to either answer those questions or look at him and say, hey, look, I got it. I've got the same question. I'll give you the answer I got, and then we got to drive on. Got it? And that's life, according to the Marine Corps. And so I think it speaks well of units that do that. And where are we, Nick? Number seven?
Well, let me add one
sure. One
comment to what we've just been talking about. No, we're going to go to six next. But
right. One
of my favorite quotes from a famous military leader, Dwight David Eisenhower, he was the Allied commander during World War II, he said on the eve of Operation Overlord, when questioned, he said, I've found that when the battle commences, plans, meaning the stack of paper, are useless, but planning is essential. If you think about that, essentially what he's saying is it's a constant, constant communication between everyone. And I've taken that into my business ethic, which is I plan the work and then I work the plan. It does no good for you to do plans and to show your boss or your leader, oh, I have my operational plan. Here it is. It's 24 pages. What's important is that that everybody is communicating about that plan on a regular basis, on a daily basis. In the military, I would think it's got to be on a daily basis. In business, it could probably be on a weekly basis. But I just think that whole part of it is extremely important.
Well said.
Okay. Number six. Number six. And before everybody jumps off the skyscraper when I say this, when I talk about chemical weapons, I'm talking about non-lethal chemical weapons. I am not proposing or expounding that we should just spray the area with sarin gas and then sort out the bodies afterwards. That's just not going to happen. But one of the things we discovered about two-thirds of the way through the fight in the Citadel was we did deploy CS gas, and I know that 2-5 deployed CS gas on the south side of the river, but unfortunately when we deployed it, most of my Marines had jettisoned their gas masks because they were just extra object hanging onto their body. I ran into a courtyard. I see these three young corporals with clean uniforms on sitting on these three big boxes. And they were E8 gas launchers, and they had just returned from NBC school, Nuclear Biological and Chemical Warfare school. And I asked them who they were and what the hell these boxes were, and they told me these are E8 gas launchers. They contain about 40 millimeter CS gas grenades, and you could flip the top off, and you could tilt it, and then you pull the lanyard, and it would push those 40 gas grenades out anywhere from 50 meters to 400 meters out in front of you. The first time we tried it, I learned that these three young corporals had never fired one of the damn things because they didn't realize that when the recoil of the first round went off, it caused the unit to go straight up in the air. So I effectively, on about the 23rd of February, gassed Charlie Company. Okay.
Nice.
I had a bunch of people screaming in my ear. But we improvised, we adapted, we overcame, we put sandbags around the damn thing so it wouldn't recoil. And then we pulled two more lanyards. The next morning, with the heavy smell of CS gas, and that's the nasty stuff, we moved through the next three blocks completely unopposed. No one was there. We had just moved four blocks, taken horrendous casualties. It had taken us nearly 2 weeks, and with the kind of accidental deployment of these E8 gas launchers, it essentially ended the battle. So that's what I'm talking about. There was a bad example of using chemical warfare a few years ago in Russia or in the Ukraine when terrorists had taken over that theater and weren't going to budge, and they had hundreds of people inside their hostages, and they tried to pump in some kind of chemical weapon, and unfortunately they were not prepared for the aftermath, and thus most of those people died. So there are resources. I've been told confidentially by a CWO5, who I tend to believe, that there are assets and resources that can be used in that situation. One of the biggest concerns I have in terms of urban warfare is a large enemy force taking over a huge skyscraper filled with tens of thousands of people. And how do you deal with that? You're going to try to, land on the top and work your way from the top down 100 floors? Pretty challenging. So that might be something to be considered, but I do not recommend the you know, blatant use of lethal chemical weapons. I think there are resources and there are chemical weapons that can be used safely that would turn things to our advantage.
All right. And you speak from your own experience in terms of we jettison, and Marines historically don't like to carry their gas masks. One of the things you want to throw in your pack and get rid of, but in terms of urban warfare, a lot easier to clear with your gas mask on than it is, yeah, and gas in the air with your enemy fleeing than it is to fight him and give him, it essentially negates his advantage, yes? One of his advantages.
Yep.
Interesting. All right, number seven.
The last item has to do with making sure that everyone in your chain of command below you as a leader understands in great detail what the plan is and what they're required to do, but not only that, but what their leader, like a fire team leader, needs to understand what his squad leader's responsibilities are. This takes time, but I think it's really important. One of the things that I've heard over the last 20, 25 years attending reunions, I'll ask a guy who was a Lance Corporal, I said, do you remember, you know, in this operation, we were in this area? And he said, no, sir, I don't remember any of that because my squad leader told me where to go, and that's where I went. Okay. I didn't ever look at a map. You lieutenants had those maps. Okay. So in urban warfare, expect chaos. Expect leadership dwindling. You lose your leader, your head's cut off, and it creates confusion and it creates chaos. And that part of operations, I believe, is very, very important. It really, everybody in your unit, if you're a platoon commander, your squad leaders need to know, but their fire team leaders need to know, and you might as well keep everybody in on the whole thing, you know, because I could go down. A squad leader could go down, a fire team leader's got to rise, take command, and move forward, understanding what's going on. Again, that takes time. Sometimes you don't have time. But I believe in my heart, Mac, that we should have taken the time. There was this artificial urgency to just go in there and kick the hell out of the NVA without really understanding what the situation was. And in my mind, that's a very lethal thing.
Isn't that has to be done, though, on a continuing basis, yes? Just on a daily,
absolutely.
On a daily basis, how you do business.
Sure, but think about OIF. They built forces for 6 months. They were developing the plan. They were practicing. They were maneuvering. They were doing all kinds of stuff. But getting close to when the Red Star cluster goes up, it needs to be even more intensified leading up to that point. That, I believe, is really, really important.
Okay. So if we could build your platoon, you know, a platoon, the ability to ask questions would be welcome and open by subordinates to seniors. In my mind's eye, I have you given an order. You know, when you finish and you look and you say, okay, questions. Everybody feels comfortable asking those questions. Nobody feels like they can't ask a question. And then the other piece of this is, you know, there's things like back briefs and things like walkthroughs that I think we've gotten much better. You know, I learned really from the Army, build big terrain models and then you make people walk on them. Okay, you're now second squad, you're third squad, you're first squad. All right, walk us through. And this would be your senior fire team leaders who now have to take over the fight. So we rehearsed it once. Now we're going to do the second rehearsal. The platoon sergeant's running it. He's the platoon commander. You three are now all squad leaders. And now we're going to walk through the exact same operation. And it gets to a point where, you know, like third squad is supposed to, you know, occupy this piece of ground or take this, you know, section of the city. And then they're supposed to orient, you know, to the east. Well, you can see because standing on the terrain model, if he doesn't orient to the east, he doesn't know that.
And so I think we've gotten, there are those techniques, but you got to do them on, it's like going to the gymnasium. You got to go there on a regular basis and do that, or else you don't develop the muscular strength and the muscle memory as an organization to go ahead and do that. Okay. All right. That's all seven of them.
One of the things that my grunts agree with is the refrain that the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in combat. Okay, and I think that's absolutely the jewel. That's absolutely true.
You know,
you're right.
I don't know that we understand that the right way, though. I think a lot of times Marines just equate it to sweat. And I was thinking about this last week. That exact phrase. It's so much deeper than we understand before we go to war. That all those little things that people tell you gotta do, you've gotta do, because if you put in that sweat equity, you'll bleed less in combat. And if I say the same thing when it comes to discipline. If you're undisciplined, you're gonna pay for it in combat. Cause your
yep.
your shit is not gonna be tight, and it's gonna be people that get dead. They're gonna get dead, they're gonna get wounded. And you have to live with that. My final question to you, now that we're done with your seven, you've had to live with this for 50 years, for 25 since you blacked it out. Do you count the 25 that you blacked it out, or do you not count that?
Oh no, it's real. It was there, Mac. It was inside of me, but it was so well hidden and compressed that I didn't really think about it much. I didn't think about it at all on a daily basis for those full 25 years. But when you get to that moment when it all comes back, and that's the way it happened to me, just in one particular moment, all of a sudden I went, oh my God, I remember it all. I remember every single thing. It becomes a full 50 years. Okay. It's just in those early days when you're, first of all, you're kind of waking up and you're realizing through friends and buddies and fellow combat veterans that what you're facing is post-traumatic stress disorder. You have to keep moving forward. You have to learn, you have to understand, and you have to take action. You have to start working on it. Because if you basically just give up, you say, and I've seen a couple of guys who are basically just completely ruined because they don't think they can fix themselves or that there's nobody out there that can help them. It's sad to see, because it is inside them and it eats at them.
Okay, so let me ask you this, Nick. I mean, even if we go back 25 years, you're talking 17, you're talking 1992. We weren't doing mental health post-combat related mental health in 1992. I think we'd coined the term post-traumatic stress disorder, but it certainly wasn't looked at as normal for guys who went to war. It was, oh, he's one of those wackadoodle guys. He can't handle it. You know, so I guess the final question I would ask you, you're no stranger to post-combat related mental health and the weight of command fighting in war where you lose Marines. What advice would you give young leaders about your experience and what you've lived through?
Well, I think the most important thing is for the individual, that young leader, needs to understand what that is all about, that it's very real. It's not just a mental disorder, it's a physical disability. What happens to the human being when they're faced with the fight or flight syndrome? Essentially, you see a truck coming at you 80 miles an hour and you're in the way. It's automatic. It's not something that you have to tell your body to do. Your mind is kind of numb. You either run or you die. You either fight or you run. And it's not anything that you can really control. And what happens in that moment is your limbic system is pumped full of chemicals, adrenaline and others,
And over time, it actually disables that system, which is the system that controls human relationships. I learned that the hard way. And it took many years for counselors and friends to kind of pound that into my head. I said, Nick, you're all fucked up. This is what's going on. You need to get some counseling. You need to, you know, start working every day. When you get up in the morning, go find something to do. Don't sit there in the bed and be all depressed, because it's just going to take over your life. So I have had the kind of the joy of speaking to young college students in a psychology class and also a VA hospital and all of their staff. And when I walk in the room, because they've been told, hey, here comes a Vietnam veteran with PTSD, I walk in the room and I've got my suit and tie and my shiny shoes on, and I'm standing tall, okay? And they look at me and they go, oh, no, he can't possibly have that. Well, guess what? I do, and it's something that I live with every day. And I think young leaders need to understand what that is. It doesn't happen to everybody. It doesn't happen when you get into that fight or flight situation once or twice or even a few times. But if you've been in that situation dozens of times, and in my case it was hundreds of times over the course of 12 and a half months, you are missing something. And it's not something to be, it's not a dishonorable thing. It's a very human thing. And honestly, I mean, I knew a couple of guys in the Basie School in boot camp who feared nothing. They just were that way. Most of those guys are dead, okay, because they didn't have that warning signal. They didn't, he just went, hey, I'm going to go wipe out that bunker. Well, 5 seconds later, he's dead as a doornail. So I'd rather be working with leaders who are human, who understand that if they stand up and start running towards a machine gun, they're likely going to die real quick, to use their brain, to use their leadership skills, to inspire their men to do it, to take care of business, but to do it the right way, at the right time. And usually that's easy to do if you're a leader when everything's calm and nobody's shooting at you. But when you're in challenging circumstances, that's when the true leadership rises. So what I would say to young leaders is learn to live the Marine Corps' leadership principles and traits. Make them a part of your daily life. Those will make your life down the road so much better. If you can make those traits, if you can become that Marine who has studied those things, and who lives them every day, it will pay off in untold ways and in large numbers all through the rest of your life. So that's what I would recommend.
And just to double back, in terms of the mental health stuff and living with it, with what you do on the battlefield, expect that if you go into harm's way, you're going to come out of there with some baggage. Don't be afraid to put your hand up and get help. Understand that's absolutely positively normal for people that have that experience, and there's nothing wrong with you. Yes?
Yep. That's correct. One of the wonderful things about the way, and I believe this was a lesson from the Vietnam War, you know, when we first went to war, when we first had boots on the ground in 1965, units arrived together. And they did amphibious assaults, and they did search and destroy, and they were all together. But within a few months, because of the realities of terms of enlistment and so forth, guys would go home, and new guys would join. And it became a revolving door. By the time I got there in mid-November 1967, I was an individual. I was one person that went to war by myself and was assigned to, fortunately, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. And when I was done with my tour, I went home by myself. The wonderful thing about the way it's done these days is it's a unit deployment. It's a unit deployment cycle. For example, in the 5th Marines, when it came their turn to go to the sandbox, the regimental command group would go first, and they called them a regimental combat team.
Right.
It's the CO, it's his staff, it's particular assets. They get all set up, and then the battalions, and that's a 12-month tour, the battalions then come in intact. It's a 7-month tour. They fight together, they live together, and they go home together. And they bury their dead together. Okay. Oftentimes we never had that opportunity. There were a few kind of on the spot memorial services for guys that we lost in a particular battle. To my knowledge, there was never any memorial service, undertaken for the Battle of Way City, which I think would have been good. One of the problems with that when you're in a situation like the Vietnam War, where basically wherever you were, you weren't really 100% safe. Even if you were in the biggest combat base, bad things could happen to you. So I just think that is a much better system of taking turns on the battlefield. And so when you get home, you're still together and you're still in the Marine Corps, but you can sit and talk. And you can shoot the shit, and you can tell war stories, and you can laugh, and you can cry. And a lot of that pent-up stuff inside of you is, it doesn't go away, but it's neutralized to some degree. So I think that's a really wonderful outcome of what we went through, as the military leaders, particular guys like Jim Mattis, realized that we can't do this individual rotation system.
Right.
It just doesn't give guys enough time to defuse, and then all of a sudden you're in civilian clothes and you're out on the street.
And one addition to that, when you do come home and you are part of a unit and you do all those things together, when guys begin to struggle, you have that support network now, especially, that says, hey, it's okay,
man.
Go to mental health. There was a day when if you said, hey, I'm going to mental health, everybody stopped and looked. Now, you know, Ward's at going to the library to get a book. McNamara's at mental health. You know, Rogers is going to the gym, and nobody bats an eye. We're more concerned about guys who don't go to mental health, because that's when people get in trouble. My guest for almost 3 hours has been Nick Warr. We've been talking about 1st Platoon Charlie Company, 1st Battalion 5th Marines, 1967, 1968, in particular, the Battle of Hue City. So, Nick, first of all, per usual, I can't thank you enough for doing this, for being the second person to come on and talk about as part of the Battle Studies feature, to talk about their experiences, give their advice, and certainly appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mac, I appreciate you having me on. I consider it an honor to talk with you, and I love our conversation. So anytime, my friend.
All right. More on All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right. I think the longest show we've ever done. Yeah. So anyway, that'll do it. If you're just tuning in, you will go ahead and hear news headlines at the top of the hour. Females at MCT on the West Coast. That's news, evidently. The Niger investigation getting ready to be released. Hasn't been released yet, so we're standing by on that. The Navy scrapping F-18s, so you'll hear about that. And other DOD headlines. So you'll hear that. And then the inaugural, let's see, how do I say it? The first time we've ever done a segment I've been wanting to do for a while, and it's, still don't have a name. I'm struggling, struggling for a name for it, but it's essentially retired Marines talking leadership, specifically specifically directed to junior leaders. And the first person that had on, who's absolutely phenomenal when you listen to him. In fact, I was thinking about it after we did it. Had I scripted it, I couldn't have done it any better. Yeah, so you'll hear the Gunner talking leadership and why he thinks NCO leadership is so important and how you have to do it and the link between what you do in garrison and what happens in combat. So, yeah, Mike Musselman, probably one of the best leaders that I've seen in my life, who could you could take your rank off. Mike Musselman's still going to be our leader. Doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter where he is or what he's doing. He'll be a leader. So, awesome first show about that. And then our second battlefield study about Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines in Way City in 1968. And I want to thank Nick War again for giving up so much of his time for us to do that. And yeah, pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. And again, Nick's story is, you know, rules of engagement, you know, not doing a battle handover, and then 29 of his 50 Marines are either killed or wounded in three frontal assaults on the first day of heavy fighting that 1-5 got into inside Hue. So, you'll hear about that. Have a great afternoon on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio, out.